first, I did apologize for the benefit of those who came early and those who came late. I apologize because I had to, it's a matter that I had to go and address the office of the speaker. I know our notice was saying 9:30. Well, at times there are situations that are beyond our control. It is not about undermining you, but our apologies. Two, I think it's important for the benefit of those that may be coming for the first time in the portfolio committee. Phones are on silence. There are people that are designated to take photos. We know them, and it's only those people that are designated to do that. No person is allowed to take a photo in a committee setting. Three, it's only the presenters and honorable members who will interact with one another in terms of presentation and questions. Answers, it will still be the leadership of SANAC. If you want to speak during a break, during our break, you will rub shoulders and communicate. Otherwise, it's only these, unfortunately, these people that are around the table, and we hope the entire leadership of SANAC, those that have delegated the responsibility, are on my left. Because of time, normally we make introduction. It's members that are going to introduce themselves. They are going to be using mics. The leadership of SANAC will also introduce itself. Because we are quite a group, I would humbly propose that if, for an example, there is a group, a civil society group led by one person, it will be that person that says, I'm Lindelwa Tunjwa, I'm here with four people. The thing is, introduction in a group, big as this, takes most of our time. But it's important that we will try and get a way of knowing who is here. The reason for that is because we don't want to hear things outside and we don't know who was here. And we are asked things and we don't know. Because it's the first meeting of this kind of SANAC. SANAC is dealing with such sensitive issues, important issues, motive issues, and we don't want a stampede in that. So as we will be, I think the Secretariat will find a better way. But as I'm saying, if you are a civic organization led by somebody, please you will say, I'm here with this, I'm so-and-so, I am here with this the number of people. Otherwise, I don't want to say it's unfortunate, CEO and members, but I just want to say we are interacting with SANAC towards the end of our term. And it's not that we have not been interacting with SANAC. At some point, if you watch TV, you know that we have been asking questions as members of parliament, to then the deputy president, and even the current deputy president, has been interacting. But it has always been our endeavor, our interest to have SANAC to come and have some interaction. So I think we are really happy, we are meeting SANAC. Maybe a coincidence. Yesterday we were launching a South African TB caucus, a very important structure. And knowing very well, and I think I want to echo what has been echoed by a number of people, the speakers, and that TB doesn't have any color, doesn't know any color, doesn't have any boundaries. I will say it does not even have any political affiliation, whether you're rich, whether you're poor, whether you are young, whether you are old. It's so we are meeting you at that time, and for me, I was deployed to a standard PF last week, which was talking about key persons, key population, and the issue of other countries also reflecting on the. They are not calling it SANAC, but they call it as And I learned quite a lot that, in fact, maybe as much as we've got progressive legislation in the country, but there is a grey area that we are to deal with. And I think as members of parliament, we have to encourage that speaking, interacting with our communities, because African communities, by their nature, in particular black people, are conservative in talking about issues of sexuality, issues of sex workers, homosexuals, with the understanding that there is no person who sleeps and wake up said, I want to be a homosexual. It's categories. There are those that are born with genes that are mixed up, and a person doesn't understand what is happening with him or herself. How then to ensure I can structure here like yourself and ourselves, because that also falls within your issues of homosexuality, that how then to empower communities to understand in that deep rural area, how then to ensure that that mother, instead of shying away or putting that child in a particular corner, but is able to then say, I want to be assisted because this child does not understand what is. So the thing of that, how then to ensure that we create an enabling environment for our people to talk about this thing, because whether we like it or not, we're in the 21st century. These things, they are being talked about by other people, but how then to ensure that even those that are talking about this whole area that SANAC is, they don't ridicule, so that people don't go in under, because when they go under, things are becoming worse. So we want to be a society. We understand, we respect one another, the issues of human rights. So I'm a bit quite excited. I so wish we could be here the whole day, but unfortunately we are here until a little bit, maybe after 1 or towards 2 o'clock. Otherwise, those are my welcoming remarks. We will then, towards us as honourable members, and we are first, and I think in SANAC, and the people that are going to present, that we introduce ourselves fully, using the mics. My name is Linda Ladunjwa. I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Health. On my left is Vilgas Machalamba, who is the secretary to the Portfolio Committee. The left against the wall is Nolitan Melendezi, who is the secretary of the study group of the African National Congress. Next to her is Mbali, our committee assistant. Next to her is Yolisa, who is our media person, the extreme, Zubair, our researcher. Moses was somewhere on the right. Moses was also part of the research team, and Lindo Kuhle, who is our committee content advisor. I will then look. I will then hand over to honourable members to introduce themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to you. My name is Lindy Wilson. I am a member of this Portfolio Committee.
Good morning to everybody. My name is Ishmael Salela.
Good morning, Mulini, Sanbonani. Igamalam, Dingumbule Nkonzo, a member of this Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Rachel Adams, member of the committee.
Okay, I'll hand over to you. See, or how you do your introduction depends on you, but it's important that we know your team.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members and colleagues around the room. My name is Sandile Buthelezi. I'm the CEO of the SANAC Trust. Accompanying me from the SANAC Trust Executive, I've got three executive members. I'll start on the left. That side is Dr. Slingers, Neveline Slingers, who's our executive for donor coordination. She's also looking for after the NSP implementation unit. I will leave that to gentlemen from the presidency. I'll come to my immediate right. It's our executive for stakeholder management, Reverend Nebudalu, Zo Nebudalu. And then on my left-hand side, I've got Ms. Nola Zikasa, who's our executive for strategic information. Then I've got the team from the presidency who will always support us, but I will allow the team to, I don't know who's going to introduce them. But before I also stop, I'd also like to say that we have the national leader of the civil society, who is also a co-chair of SANAC with the deputy president, Ms. Steve Letzike, who is going to introduce the team she's with from the civil society. I will stop at that.
Good morning, Honourable. Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Lawrence Matemba. I'm from the Presidency, from the Office of the Chair of SANEC, Deputy President David Mabuza. With me, I have Mr. Lois Khumalo. He's also from the Office of the Deputy President. And behind the gentleman over there is Mr. Ivanhoe Magileng. He's also from the Office of the Deputy President. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honourable Chair. Good morning, colleagues, Honourable Members. My name is Steve Letzike. I'm the co-chair of SANEC. I'm also the chairperson of the National Civil Society Forum. And I do have delegates of Civil Society Forum who are members of the task team, Civil Society Task Team on TB. That side. So we do have Ingrid, we have Spongile Sabalala from Keep an Action Campaign, we have Jacqueline from COSATU, we have Mabalani Mfundisi from Sports, Arts and Culture, we have Andrew as well from TDC, and then we've got Bura from the National Association of People Living with HIV. Thank you.
Can this I don't know why they didn't introduce themselves, the two.
Yeah, my chair is Greg Mangua from Office of the Minister.
Can I just the two ladies?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Nol Babalo. I'm from Trauma Center. I'm coming with Auntie Jenny, the HTF counselor.
All right. On my extreme left, well, so far, there are four chairs here. You are seated, the lady there at the corner. Come up. Okay. You remove this side.
There we are.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Denise Parks. I'm from the health professional sector, and I have a delegation of 7, of which those 2 are along with me.
We are now in apologies. The first apology is that Honorable Wilson is going to leave us before, because he has got a meeting with her chief whip. Honorable Ndaba is not well. Honorable Mapala will join the committee later. He has gone to see a doctor. Ms. Kopana, unforeseen circumstances. Dr. Tembe Kwayo, unforeseen circumstances. Honorable members, those are the apologies that we're having. There will be a time that also the committee secretary will just dash out preparing for something, which is also in line with what I was dealing with this morning with the Office of the Speaker. Honorable Mahlale.
I'll also request to release at 12:45. Got the meeting.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Members. We are now going to hand over to you, CEO, to present to us. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just as a preamble, we circulated the presentations in advance, but having been part of happenings yesterday and most of the honorable members were participating in the debate yesterday that we were in the gallery for, so we want to apologize in advance that there are some slides that we've adjusted, there are some things that we've taken out because we thought when we were preparing the presentations, we did not have the benefit of the hindsight on how involved the members have been in terms specifically of HIV and TB, and we thought some of the things might be repetitive. So there might be a bit of a mismatch in some areas in terms of the presentation and the documents that are in front of the members. So the way we've structured the presentation, looking at the time, we thought that we'll just do a few slides again, just reminding all of us on what SANAC is and it's about. Then the bulk of the presentation is actually on the summary of the National Strategic Plan, and we've just picked up the key and pertinent points on the NSP, which was launched 18 months ago. And then we thought we're not doing justice because we're now 18 months into the NSP if we can't pick up on some of the areas of progress in the implementation of the NSP. Then we're now on a slide that has got a SANAC structure. That slide has got different colors, but just again as a reminder, the SANAC structure is quite huge. At the topmost of the structure being the plenary, which is co-chaired by the Deputy President and the Civil Society Chair. And within that, then it's different structures from government, which is mainly through the Interministerial Committee, the Civil Society Forum, chaired by the Chair of the Society, and then the private sector. And that group together then forms the plenary. And the two main committees through which the plenary depends on its work is the Program Review Committee. That's really the technical committee that leads all the work, currently chaired by the DG for Health and co-chaired by Dr. Matume from this, the Civil Society. And then we also have a Resource Mobilization Committee that really says all this technical work, how do we actually resource it in terms of resources, looking at all the avenues that are used to finance the response. And that committee is chaired by the Minister of Health, co-chaired by Mabalane, just across us here from the civil society. And this committee looks then at the money that comes from government, the current 124 billion that government is spending in this financial year. It looks at the money that should be coming from PEPFAR
as the second largest funder of the response. Then the Global Fund, we are going to spend a bit of time on the Global Fund CCM, because we've got a few slides as we are at the verge of getting new money from them. And then, of course, at the extreme right, it's a FANAC Trust. Now, the trust was established as a legal structure. I'm going to talk a bit about it. And those are my employers. It's a legal entity that actually looks after all the FANAC work in the country. So that is the structure of FANAC as in the current procedural guidelines. I'll then move on to the next slide. Talk a bit about the trust. It's a legal structure established by cabinet, and it drives all FANAC-related activities. It's governed by the trust deed, of course, in terms of the Trust Property Control Act, and it's got 11 trustees. 5 of those trustees are from the FANAC structures, and 6 are independent trustees. All trustees are actually appointed by the Deputy President after consultations with the Deputy Chair of FANAC and the Minister of Health. The Chair of the Trust is appointed by the Deputy President, and the sitting Chair currently is Dr. Nvaluba, who's a group executive with Discovery Health and a former DG of Foreign Affairs. And, of course, the CEO and the executive within the Secretariat, we're all accountable to the Board of Trustees. Then moving on now to the actual National Succession Plan itself, the summary thereof. When this plan was actually written, there were some successes that were actually considered to show that the country was moving forward. So I'm now on the slide that says the recent successes that inspire us. We know that we've seen a huge drop in HIV infection from 2006 to 2016, and it was actually a drop of almost more than 400,000, and the deaths had also dropped extremely high from 70,000 to 38,000 by 2015, still a lot, but it's also a huge drop. Then, of course, the life expectancy that the minister and all politicians always talk about had improved significantly, and the high rollout number of ART infections, when the NSP was written, it was 3.7, though that is now close to a million more than that. And the HIV infections had dropped from 410,000 in 2011 to 270,000 in 2016. And of course, we will talk about this later, because a year later we've got other figures which are a bit lower than that now. So looking at this, of course, we had to be cognizant of the fact that when we were writing this NSP, you will not have this slide, but we thought that it's always good to look at ourselves versus the whole globe, that as much as we are only less than 1% of the global population, almost 20% of paid HIV is in this country. 15% of all new infections globally are in this country. And out of these, 34% are in the young 16 to 24. And all deaths globally, 15% of those which are HIV related are in South Africa. And we've got in the whole globe, in terms of people who are on treatment, 20% of those are in the country. That's how we actually run the highest or the largest ART program in the whole globe. And in this country, I'm not going to spend time. The minister spoke a lot about this in terms of the number of deaths, but also in terms of sexually transmitted infections, we treat more than a million a year. And the problem with them that most of them are asymptomatic. Now, this actually shows how big the problem compared to our actual proportion of population versus the global population. The new NSP, what are the key highlights before we go into each of the goals? One, the main principle of the NSP is one country, one plan, one response. It's a fourth generation NSP. Of course, it's aligned to the National Development Plan and also the Sustainable Development Goals. It was launched in March 2017. Few key differences with the previous NSP. We've moved away from percentage targets to numeric targets. It's got expanded goals, and it's very vociferous on key populations programming, as the chair was referring to key populations. And it also talks a lot about resource mobilization and has put leadership on top. And I mean, what was happening yesterday is one of the areas that we're very proud that The NSP talks of leadership, and that's the launch of the global the caucus, TP caucus, by Parliament is actually part of that area that the NSP is actually advocating for. As mentioned, it's got 8 goals. The first goal is on prevention of HIV, TB and STI new infections. The second goal is on preventing mortality and morbidity through the provision of treatment, care and adherence support. Goal 3, no one should be left behind, specifically looking at key populations with tailor-made services. Goal 4, it looks at addressing social, economic and cultural drivers that fuel the 3 epidemics. And then goal 5, it's actually looking at how do we embed our response on a human rights approach. Goal 6, specifically looking at leadership and shared accountability. Goal 7 is how do we mobilize resources. Goal 8 is, of course, looking at how do we actually ensure that we monitor our response and report accordingly. Then we spent a bit of time on each of the goals. We're not going to bore the honorable members, but on prevention, basically we're looking at putting prevention back at the top to ensure how we actually, of course, we'll never treat ourselves out of this epidemic. So we really need to double our efforts in terms of prevention, looking at sexual risk reduction programs, communications, condom promotion, mass distribution, youth-friendly services, and all other activities we're doing. But also one ensuring that we look at all those interventions that are always difficult to either fund or to either measure, which are social and structural. And of course, again, not forgetting that we've got our biomedical interventions that are proven to work and are actually evidence-based, and those all the time always get more funding, because most of the funders, they look forward into funding something that you can back by evidence. Critically looking at voluntary medical male circumcision, pre-export of prophylaxis, TASP or treatment prevention, and then ensuring that we address the weaklings in terms of vertical transmission. We know this is one of the success stories that we have in terms of vertical transmission, but we've not really eliminated the transmission. So, and we also don't want to reverse the gains that we've gained in terms of prevention of mother-to-child transmission. And then, of course, sexually transmitted infections. This is the area that we do admit that the country has been a bit weak on. We've all been with sexually transmitted infections for a long time, and it's really a problem that in this day and age we still have infections from gonorrhea, chlamydia, and of course congenital syphilis, and diseases that really should not be happening. But the problem is the actual screening, a high index of suspicion, because most of them are actually not symptomatic. People walk around not knowing that they've got sexually transmitted infection. But we also know that specifically, especially the ulcerative ones, they actually increase the probability of acquisition of HIV. But critical to that, we know that we've introduced the cervical cancer vaccine for young girls 9 to 13, and it's actually human papillomavirus vaccine, and specific strains that at a later stage, if someone has been infected with them, they may get cervical cancer. So there is that vaccination in place. It's been introduced in the country, and we really need to ensure that it reaches the target group of the young girls that are actually targeted with that vaccine. But also critically is ensuring that for every sexually transmitted infection treated, a partner need to be traced. Partner or partners. So we know all that those times when we started practice, we used to give those yellow cards, but also linking up with the private sector, because there's evidence that most of the people then don't come to the public sector, want to go to the private sector. And these sexual transmitted infections are actually a low-hanging fruit to treat, as long as we pick them up and ensure that we use syndromic management for them. And then of course, I'm not going to spend much time on treatment, but we know that What's more critical is scaling up the testing and putting people on treatment. We now have universal treatment, universal testing and treatment UTT, and I'll talk about the 1990 later on and where we are as a country. But more importantly, also linked to this is the whole cascade, availability of reactive treatment, the adherence, the treatment fatigue, and also ensuring that we introduce better drugs, better tolerated drugs. And I know there's quite a lot going on right now in terms of introducing the new regimens, but also to ensure that people are properly managed and are on proper nutrition. TB treatment and care, that was said a lot yesterday, and I wouldn't want really to bore the honorable members about TB treatment, getting those people that are missing, putting them on treatment, staying on treatment, and having a treatment success rate showing the 1990 for TB is very critical. The minister did mention yesterday that, I mean, we need to have very strong links with the private sector in terms of ensuring that people diagnosed are referred to the public sector. I mean, the people that are, with some of them, we think they are missing. So they are missed, but they do present to healthcare providers, be it public or private, but they are not being properly diagnosed. But all facilities should actually be screening everyone for tuberculosis, as almost 90% of us actually do have latent TB. And then, of course, drug-sensitive TB, that was well mentioned yesterday, drug-resistant TB, multi-drug-resistant TB, using of different drugs, of course, the availability now of bedaquiline, and all the other work that is going on in this area. Again, I've spoken about detection of STIs. Critically is their management to ensure that they manage. But I must just mention, Honorable Chair, that one of the critical areas that is important is that there's still less capacity within the health workers to detect sexually transmitted infections in some key populations, specifically in men who have sex with men, and also ensuring that those are properly treated. One key issue in the practice of medicine is to always have a high level of index, and if you don't ask for it, if you don't probe for it, you will miss it. But some, they will pick it up, but they are not well equipped in terms of what some of the treatment regimen might differ a bit in terms of that. Then our goal three, which actually looking at the key populations, and the explanations of who are the key populations. And we know that we've got different micro epidemics within different populations, and we know that if we don't address these micro epidemics, we'll never address the whole epidemic at large. And then what we've done then in the other slide that has got three columns, we've actually put in who are the HIV, STI, and key populations, looking at sex workers, the transgender people, men who have sex with men, people who use drugs, inmates of correctional facilities, but also looking at the young and adolescent girls who are the vulnerable population, children including orphans, residents of informal settlements, mobile populations. I'm not going to read all of them, but because our co-chair of SANAC yesterday, when she delivered a speech in the launch, she actually went through this very well, so I don't want to spoil the ears of the members, because I saw most of the members when she spoke about these key populations yesterday. So what's key here is that there is no size fit all. What's very important is that you need to tailor make services that fit different scenarios of different key populations, to ensure also that there are issues of human rights around that, on how you actually approach them. We all know that we still have an issue, which I'll talk a bit about when I talk about the sex worker plan late, on the whole issue of DCRIM, and we actually appreciate the work that has been done by the Parliamentary Women's Caucus to start doing the work on how actually that work can unfold moving forward. Because whatever services that we put around, if there's still criminalization and what is happening, the abuse that is happening, it becomes quite very difficult. We are actually counteracting each other in terms of the work that we're trying to do in terms of that. I'll then move on to goal four, which is addressing social and structural drivers of HIV, TB, STIs, and link these efforts to the National Development Plan. And we know that if you don't address factors like poverty, hunger, poor housing, domestic violence, family breakdown, I mean, intact families alone, they are a huge positive if you want to address some of these issues. Drug abuse, alcohol abuse, all these are the areas that we need to have programs. And that's why we're actually working quite closely with the Department of Social Development and other programs to actually try and expand programs that are specific to these areas to address these social and structural drivers, as in goal number four. Goal number five is grounding the response on the principles of human rights. This is very critical. I'm going to spend a bit of time later when I talk about the progress on the work that is being done here. But we all know that grounded on the Constitution guarantees rights to equal treatment, freedom from discrimination, and access to health and social services. So there's quite a lot of work we're doing with a number of organizations, and again, let me pick up on that when I speak on the progress. Goal number six is promoting leadership and shared accountability for a sustainable response to HIV, TB, and STIs. Again, this is one innovation that this NSP came about, that if you don't have proper leadership at different levels of government, you will always have a problem. That's why the council at a national level, bringing on different leadership from government and the civil society and private sector, is key to ensure that at a national level there is this cohesive messaging and driving of the response. But again, in the provinces, the councils in the provinces under the chairmanship of the premiers is very critical, which is part of the work that as a FANAC structure we're trying to drive, and I am going to touch on it in terms of different provinces, what's happening. And again, from the provinces, moving on to the districts, in terms of the district councils, chaired by the mayors, and driving the multi-district implementation plans, that is very critical, and we'll touch a bit on that one. That's all centered around goal number six. Goal number seven, mobilization of resources to actually ensure that what we've put in this plan is achievable. Of course, we need resources, and we'll talk a bit about that as we move on with the next slides. But critically is that the response in South Africa, one of the most important things that is mainly almost 94% is funded from the fiscus, which is unlike the other countries. I mean, I was sharing with my colleagues that previous, I had an advantage of working in many countries in Africa where you knew that if Americans withdrew the money, that response would be dead. It's not the case in South Africa. Actually, they are just a very small percentage. We'll talk about the figures when we come, we go on to the later stage. So our government is very critical, and that's one key example of leadership in terms of investing resources and ensure that the response is actually funded by the government. But we need to look at more modalities, more public-private partnerships in funding the epidemic, more innovative methods like the social impact bond. There's some work that we're doing on that to see what are the other methods we can bring in to ensure that we've got sustainable funding. Because, I mean, there's an increasing pressure on the fiscus of the country itself to sustain other priorities that are there other than these priorities. Then the last goal is, of course, is on strategic information. If you're putting so many resources, resources in terms of human, in terms of leadership, in terms of money, you need to be able to measure if you're achieving something, are you getting somewhere. So if it ain't measured, it ain't done. Finish. So that's basically the main goals that are in, but then there's a slide where we're really looking at what are the critical factors of that we need in terms of the success. Of course, if we actually work as silos, there's HIV there, there's TB there, there's STI, we really need to integrate our services, which is why later on when we talk about the upcoming wellness campaign, you'll see how we actually want to integrate all the services, including the chronic diseases that are now becoming a huge epidemic in the country, that we need to need them. But we also need to ensure that we develop services that meet people's needs, that are not only really around what we think, but what do people think in terms of the services moving forward. Of course, these services, most of them are commodity-based, procurement of airways, procurement of chairs, procurement of all these things. So we need to have systems that are efficient, that are easy to measure, that are also immune to some corrupt activities, so to ensure that the money goes to the right people in the right places at the right time. And of course, these services need human resources for help. You need people to do the testing. You need people to put people on treatment. You need people to do all this work. So you need to have good capacity in terms of human resources in the country so that we are able to reach some of this. But we need some issues in terms of strengthening the fabric of the society, moral regeneration, social cohesion. Specifically, if you're looking, ensuring that we've got a good economy that can absorb people in employment, because all of those are part of the social and structural drivers of HIV. I think, Chair, I will stop there with the summary of the NSP, and I would like to move on to, in the first year, what can we report on the NSP? Moving on to prevention, just to set the scene, when we put in the targets, in 2016 we were sitting at 278,000 new infections, and at that time we thought if we can at least reach 100,000 by 2022, which is the lifetime of this NSP, we would have done well as a country. However, 6 months later after the launch of the NSP, we were all called to Geneva, delegation led by the Minister of Health, the co-chair of SANAC, and a number of countries were called by the United Nations Joint Program on HIV UNAIDS. They told us that, look guys, we can see your targets. We've done the calibration for all the countries using our model. We think that if you think that you want to go for 100,000 by 2022, you are letting the whole world down. We as well want to use South Africa to reach 88,000 2 years earlier by 2020. So you will then see then that the target that is on that slide, it says 270,000 to 88,000. That's what they've asked us to do by 2020. They never asked for permission. They did it. They said, you shall do it as a country. See how you reach it. So that's a target that we are given. It's a huge, huge target to reach. I've taken out a lot of slides here to explain how difficult it would be, where we've actually done modeling to look at different interventions to see what you need to do, obviously looking at the investment case and what's available, what can be achieved. We thought it was very difficult still. However, we thought we can actually work on that. So specifically looking at the adolescent girls, the 15 to 24, they actually expect us to decrease that from 94,000 per annum, at the current rate, to 12,000 by 2020. So that's what the country globally is being expected to do. Hence, it cannot be business as usual. But can we achieve these ambitious targets? It's going to be very difficult, but we need to focus on a number of issues. We really need to focus on evidence-based prioritization. We need to really understand the drivers and risk at a local level. Most of the risk, they cannot be homogeneous. If you're sitting where I come from, in Eshowe, in the northern part of KwaZulu-Natal, it's difficult from what's happening in the city of Cape Town. So you need to understand the epidemics at a local level and tailor-make interventions to that level and then scale up in that area to be able to achieve that. Of course, you need to customize them, as I mentioned. We really need to implement change the way we're doing things. I was saying I've worked in HIV for almost 20 years. Maybe it's time to allow the new minds to come in. Maybe my ideas have gone past. Maybe those are some of the things that we also need to think about. Targeting is going to be very critical. Innovation. expand and enhance advocacy and critical for that is policy change. And I mean, we've got vast evidence to show that if you change policies and accountability methods, we are able to actually hold people accountable and reach forward. After that, then, because if we want to really win this war, we need to win it in the adolescent girls 15 to 24, because that's where there's a huge problem in this country. We then had a summit in April over 2 days, put together different role players, including the young girls, young men, the thought leaders in that area, researchers, everyone, departments around the room. We came up with key recommendations of the things that we needed to be addressed. One is inclusion of boys and young men in all HIV prevention programs, because there's been a feeling that the young boy has been neglected. We've been spending more time on the young men whilst he's growing up in a traditional method that ends up being a problem later. So we really need to get them in that area. That's why in my language they say eventually self, no matter what I say, my poop. So we also need to ensure that there's better consultation of parents. This is a critical area involving parents, because in some areas you can see that it feels like some of these programs are taking over the role of the parent, and the parent is very critical in actually ensuring that the child grows. So parenting programs, ensuring consent, understand what is happening around HIV and how do you bring up kids in this area is very critical. HIV need to increase knowledge about and access to sexual and reproductive health services, family planning and contraception. Now, this is a huge problem in terms of contraception. In the era of HIV, of course, condoms are contraception as a barrier method, but in that, we've neglected the hormonal contraceptives. As a result, we've got a boom in teenage pregnancies, we've got a boom in termination of pregnancies, both legal and illegal, which means that there's something that we're not doing right. So people are not using condoms, they are neither using contraception, which is a problem which I think as a health worker, we've dropped the ball there in terms of ensuring that we also ensure that contraceptive safety are very important. Availability of pre-exposure prophylaxis, very, very critical. We know that we've got some sites now, but there's a plan for expanding. It's known to work. So we really need to try and really move a bit faster in the expansion. We know that in all the tertiary institutions now in the country that's being expanded, and there's quite a number of sites that have been increased. Sexuality education at all levels, very critical, specifically in schools. There's been an argument in terms of are we starting it early or late, because we all know that now, for example, at high school level, you cannot be talking about puberty because it now starts earlier, long before the kids actually go even to secondary school. But there's quite a lot of work the Department of Basic Education is doing around that, working with the different partners. Distribution of condoms. I mean, we distribute almost 1 billion condoms in the country. But research recently, I will talk about it, shows that there hasn't been an increase in the utilization thereof. How do we ensure that there's aggressive condom marketing to ensure that it gets used? So we're working very hard on that one. And again, the social behavior change programs for social and structural drivers, critically drugs, and also addressing issues of mental health. I mean, those are all the issues that you are seeing that they are coming up now. We don't know whether they've been there, they've been suppressed, but we can see there's much more reporting moving forward now. M&E and checking system to measure the impact of the programs is critical. Empowering political and community leaders with necessary information to champion programs for HIV on the ground and increase agency on the ground in terms of eliminating new infections amongst adolescent girls and women. Advocacy efforts, those are all the issues that we should be working on. Now, post then the NSP, what was done was that The NSP will never be implemented at national. Provinces needed to develop what we call provincial implementation plans. So there was an aggressive drive over the first year driven by the NSP steering committee. Fortunately, Mabalane is here. He was a co-chair of the steering committee, which was initially chaired, which is actually chaired in the presidency, just to ensure that we assist provinces to develop their implementation plans in the provinces, which we can now safely say that actually all provinces have produced their plans, though there are some provinces like Gauteng that are limping. There's Northwest, which I'll talk a bit about, it's got its own problems, but they were able to work with them to develop a plan, but they don't have an AIDS council. And again, of course, we've then moved on to the district to say at a district level, that's where the actual implementation is. So we need to have multi-district implementation plans. We managed to develop 46 of those out of 52, with the exception of the Western Cape. The Western Cape, actually, they only have a provincial plan because they don't have, we've had a meeting with them, but they don't believe in a district-based HIV approach, but more of they link it to the district health plans, which is a legislative mandate in terms of the National Health Act. So hence they don't have an MDIP for their provinces, which we've tried to argue with them, because for example we said you cannot have a homogeneous plan for the whole of Western Cape when more than 70% of infections are in the city of Cape Town. And you say you have the same plan as in the Central Karoo, where you have almost 0.5 HIV infections. It cannot be. But anyway, there's a discussion for another level. It's been discussed at an IMC level as well. So that's what has been put in place. Of course, it's got its own challenges that we need to address in terms of how do we align with the government planning processes. Because you will find that, for example, even a district putting in the plans that talk to the targets of the NSP, and the department will tell you, no, this is not in my APP, this is all I can do, so you need to fit to what my APP is doing, not what you think the target for the province is. But that's just, I think it's a governance issue and a leadership issue that must be addressed. Then in terms of key populations, we all know that South Africa conducted and published the female sex worker plan. I mean, say after doing the female health worker survey, and then we developed a national sex worker plan for the country, which is linked to the NSP, which is what is driving our work. And we've also the first country to develop a national LGBTI plan, HIV plan. It's actually been it's a plan that has been praised by most of the countries. We've also completed national key population cascades. Normally with key populations, when you do your levels, what's the term? Well, when you do your surveys, you normally do them in larger cities. Then you'll do it in the city of Johannesburg or do it in Cape Town, but then you then you need to use some methods to actually estimate in other areas, because they're actually very expensive to do, and it's very difficult that you can do them right throughout the whole district. And we've currently just launched the second round of the female sex worker integrated behavioral survey, just to look at the numbers in terms of the sex workers in the country. On the provincial councils on AIDS, we've actually supported the establishment and institutionalization on the provincial AIDS councils, and we can safely say that 8 of the provincial AIDS councils, we can say they are functional, not at the same level. We recently had a plenary in Limpopo where the premier is presenting. The only non-functional provincial AIDS council is the Northwest, which was actually disbanded by the former premier. But there's work already in place to try and see how that Provincial AIDS Council needs to be re-established. There's been a number of discussions with the current MEC there to assist them to do that. But we also completed the functionality assessment for the PCAs in 8 provinces. We've not done the Northern Cape as yet. It's still going to be done. And we've developed the AIDS Council Capacity Building Strategy, a toolkit, and also to a guideline to say, if you want to have a properly functioning AIDS council in the province, what kind of a secretariat do you need? What technical support to run that? That has been done. And we've done capacity building in 4 provinces, in the Free State, Mpumalanga, Northwest, and Gauteng. And we're planning to actually expand this capacity to the other provinces. Now, We thought it would be unfair not to talk about the recent results of the Human Sciences Research Council survey, which is our fear. It's a population-based HIV impact study. It was done previously triennially, every 3 years, by HSRC. So it was done in 2002, 2005, 2008. Then there was a bit of a gap after 2012. So did it in 2017, and it was released a month ago, which actually tells us how far are we doing on the ground. But maybe before I go into that, it's always very important just to look at this slide. I know the honorable members are probably aware of this, because it's always very critical to understand the difference between the incidence and the prevalence, because sometimes it gets confused. When people hear that in 2012 in 2016, we had 7.1 million estimated people who are HIV positive, and now we have 7.8, which is quite bigger than that number. It to be expected if you have a very good ART program and people are no longer dying. So they are still part of you, they are still part of the prevalence, because if the number doesn't increase, it might mean that either you're doing well on incidence or more people are dying who are HIV positive. But if the pool remains high in terms of prevalence, it's also an indicator of saying you are keeping more people alive. Hence, we've got an aging population who are HIV positive. Now, giving us another problem now with the diseases of senior citizens, now having to comorbid conditions of HIV, diabetes, coronary artery disease, and all the other diseases. So now, after that, then I can then go quickly then to the next slide. Basically, what is interesting, what was presented by the Human Sciences Research Council, was that the incidence of new infections has actually dropped by 44%. And what's worrying is that the decline is only in females, but actually in males, there's a bit of an increase of the new infections. This is still being discussed in different research cycles to try and understand, because looking at all the other results in terms of what is being done in terms of condom use, there's no change. So far, the only closest explanation that everyone is mooting is that it's tough. Treatment is prevention. We've got many people who are on treatment. Hence, if someone is on treatment and is virally suppressed, they are unlikely to pass the infection to the new ones. So far, because the other interventions, from the evidence we have, doesn't show that they are the ones who might be responsible for such. But we'll allow the scientists again to fight. You'll actually laugh when you sit around and you listen to the scientists when there's an argument around these errors. But science about that is to prove someone wrong or prove someone correct and give evidence. And then the overall HIV incidence among youth, it declined by 17%. And again, it's the same thing that it's in the overall population, is that there's always an increase amongst males, but females, we see that they are more responsive in terms of the decrease in the incidence. And then I want to move to the slide that talks about overall HIV prevalence. So in 2017, the overall prevalence in all ages was around 14%, which is an increase from what it was in 2012. Now, that's a prevalence, not incidence. It's the pool, it's not the new infections. Now, this then translates to the fact that we have 7.9 million estimated people in South Africa, which is a change from 7.1 million that we had in 2016. And this is an increase of about 1.6 million more new people compared to 2012. And as I mentioned, the prevalence in 2012 was 12.2, and it's now it's actually 14. This one is by sex. That shows that the difference between males and females, which is not much of an issue. But provinces, the difference is still it's not much, except for two provinces I will talk about. But it's still KwaZulu-Natal at the top, followed by Mpumalanga, followed by Free State, followed by Northwest, then Gauteng, Eastern Cape, Limpopo. But the two provinces that are starting to worry is the Northern Cape and Western Cape. Those in those two provinces, you can see that specifically Western Cape, there's been quite a surge in the prevalence. It has increased. Again, it may be that they're doing so well in keeping people alive, but the increase is just too much if you look at the difference. So it's something that needs to be investigated further, that one needs to look at moving forward. How are we then doing? I did speak of 90-90-90. 90% of those people who are HIV positive should know their status. 90% of those who know their status should be on treatment. 90% of those who know their treatment should be virally suppressed. Because if you take tablets and you're not virally suppressed, it's as good as eating Smarties. Because you have to be virally suppressed so that you live longer, you get the benefit of treatment, but also you can't pass the virus to the other people. But what's very nice is that as a country, in terms of 1990, we're not doing badly, actually. Where we sit currently as a country, I will only look at the last one, which looks at, we don't look at females and males, but if you look at that slide, it says at the top 1999, it says 15 to 64 years of age. The last three columns, they show you that if you look at this population, we are at 85%, 71%, 88%. So we're supposed to be 90-90-90. So we're very close as a country. Even though it's written there 84.9, 70.6, 87.5. That means we're very close to the UNAIDS target in terms of 90-90-90 when it comes to HIV treatment. So in summary, the HIV incidence increased by 44% between 2012. And in terms of the numbers, it means that in 2012, we had 378,000 new infections. In 2017, they were down to 231, which is nowhere close to what we want to achieve in terms of the UNAIDS targets for 2020. But also, ART uptake has doubled after 2012. But then male medical circumcision, what we've picked up is that two-thirds of the men 15 to 24 are actually medically circumcised in South Africa, which is something that is very, very interesting. Actually, we've done very, very well in terms of medical male circumcision. So this was on the 1999, now looking at the global AIDS monitoring. I'm not going to waste time on that. Now, I want to talk a bit about the Global Fund, because I think it's of interest as part of the major funders that we get as a country. The Global Fund, I normally say it works in a funny way. It's money that different countries put together. I mean, this was one of the huge successes of the late Kofi Annan, because he's the one who actually fought for the countries to put money together for the Global Fund. So they put money into a central pot. And when that money is in the central pot, it actually loses identity. And then there's a board that sits in Geneva that actually then gives the money to the different countries. Previously, it started around 2002. I know because at that time, I mean, in South Africa, only Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal were the provinces that got money at that time. At that time, it used to be competitive like that. But then they changed the formula. They said, look, we need to look at the countries and allocate monies to the countries according to the need. Firstly, in terms of their economic status, whether they're upper middle income country, lower middle income country, and all of that. Or also in terms of the bedding of the diseases. And they're looking only on three diseases. They look on HIV, TB, and malaria. So now South Africa is regarded as an upper middle income country, but because of there's a slide that I showed that shows the burden of disease in this country. So because of the burden of disease, we still qualify for the Global Fund as a country. But then they expect that the Global Fund should be as transparent as possible, should not be dictated to by government. Hence, there is a structure called the Country Coordinating Mechanism. The Country Coordinating Mechanism, it's a constituency-based structure that has got full responsibility to do the work around the Global Fund, and I'll go through their responsibilities. Let me maybe start with their responsibilities. They do the organization, function of the CCM, and it's got its secretariat, harmonization of Global Funds with other resources in the country, the proposal development of the Global Fund, oversight of the Global Fund grants and principal recipients, documentation, communication with constituencies and the Global Fund. Hence, this structure takes the full responsibility. And this structure has got different constituencies as represented, and I will go back to that. And the way our South African structure is comprised, we've got civil society representatives. This, and also, this structure has been revised a bit, but we've got critically people living with HIV, key populations, which includes MSM, LGBTI, sex workers, the youth sector, the TB sector, people living with TB or survivors of TB, young women and girls, organized labor, and then you go. Then it's got each province being represented in the structure. So it's got one representative, then it's got specific government departments, who are the government departments who are mainly part of the IMC for SANAC. They each have representation. Then we've got the academic and research sector. Then we've got the private sector represented. Then we've got development partners, both multilateral and bilateral development partners. It's a big structure. It's got 37 members. But this is a structure that, if the proposal has been done, when they evaluate it, firstly, they in Geneva, they come and check if these members participated. Have they signed on this submission to ensure that it's actually an open process? And then it's got a chair and a co-chair. The SANAC CEO is the current chair until he gets recalled. And then the co-chair is here, or she's just gone out, is from the civil society, from COSATU, the co-chair of this structure. So I thought I must just go through this structure, because if you talk Global Fund, you talk this structure. It then works through the Resource Mobilization Committee, and it's got other committees within itself that actually ensure that work is done. And the Global Fund, they come and even audit the minutes of this structure to ensure that it meets the requirements of transparency, constituency inputs, and all of that. Now, I thought that then I will quickly go through. I will go to the slide that is a pie chart. We currently we get the Global Fund on a 3-year cycle, so we are currently towards the end of the 3 years. Of the cycle that started in 2016, we actually have exactly 6 months to the end of the current cycle. And the current cycle, the allocation of this current cycle was $323 million. Now, the other funny part about the Global Fund is that they give money to principal recipient organizations. These organizations are actually, they compete, are actually selected through a competitive process by the structure called the CCM. So the current organizations that have the money from the Global Fund, and the amounts are in that pie, in that slide with the pie chart. Unfortunately, I can see the honorable member's slides are dark, they are not in color. I apologize for that. But it shows you've got the National Department of Health is one of the principal recipients. This is standard in any country for sustainability, for National Department of Health to be the principal recipient. Because should the money go out, the Department of Health need to take over quite a number of these services anyway, moving forward. And they have the largest chunk of about 42%, which is around $129 million. Then we've got AIDS Foundation of South Africa, we've got Soul City, you've got Western Cape Department of Health, you've got Ketimbilo, you've got KwaZulu-Natal Provincial Treasury. By the way, that was before I joined, so it's got nothing to do with the fact that I'm from KwaZulu-Natal. Then you've got Right to Care, and you've got NACOSA. So these are the active principal recipients until 31 March next year. Because then the process has already started for the new grant, which I'm now going to talk about. So I wanted just to show where are we with the current grant and who is actually getting money from the Global Fund. Now, the other funny way that the Global Fund works is that, as I said, they allocate the money, but they actually tell you before you apply, they send a letter and say, South Africa, this is your allocation in the next grant. So this is what you're going to apply for. So we got this letter at South Africa. Actually, it predates my time. We got it in December 2016. The letter that actually says, as South Africa, you've been allocated $353 million as your baseline. I'll say baseline for now. And that money, in terms of the disease split, because in South Africa, they don't give us money for malaria. They only give us HIV and TB, because we don't have a very big problem with malaria, though there are other two projects where South Africa is part of the region, they get money for malaria. So they awarded us, they said this is $353 million, and they then gave us instructions on how should we actually work on this money to write on the proposal. So when we started writing the proposal, which we actively started in September 2017, to write the proposal, which we've just submitted, they then also said, in addition to this baseline of $353 million, we are giving you an extra $16 million. But this is like we're dangling a carrot. I'll put it easy that way. Though it's called catalytic funding, they say the first $5 million is, we want, if your proposal does so well, to show that your response has got very strong human rights based approach, will give you the, in addition, will give you this extra $5 million. Then they said also, because we've got a problem with adolescent girls and young women, if your baseline proposal is done so well in terms of how you're going to decrease infections in young girls, we'll give you another, the extra $5 million. Then they said, you have serious problem with missing TB patients. We've got 160,000 missing TB patients. If your baseline proposal on TB is so well written on how, on what approaches you will use, will give you extra $6 million. So that makes it $16 million. So potentially, instead of $353 million, South Africa is applying for $369 million, which is close to $370 million for the next 3 years. That's an allocation that we have. What then have we done? As from then last year, we then put together a team through the CCM to then work on the proposal for the country, and there are requirements also for writing the proposal in terms of the same constituency, in terms of going to the people for the priorities for the country, understanding that as an upper middle income country, we can't fund the normal things that the country should be funding. Hence our proposal is specifically on key and vulnerable populations, because it should be additional to what the country is covering from the fiscals and other funders are actually putting. So that our proposal then that we submitted on the 6th of August, which is now in Geneva, which went through all the structures, went through the IMC, went through the Board of Trustees, went through the Senate Plenary, the PRC, the Resource Mobilization, all the structures, actually, it went through them just to ensure that it's got a sign-off from the highest level of the country. It actually, it's a proposal that is, this is a graphic proposal that we submitted, which is looking at main key areas on comprehensive and integrated HIV, TB, and sexual and reproductive health, social economic programs for adolescent girls. Critically there, we're looking at what we will call the key principles of the She Conquers campaign as launched by the chair of SANAC 2 years ago. And then the second one, also looking at the whole issue of addressing HIV, TB in key populations, targeting men who have sex with men, transgender, sex workers, and people who inject drugs. And then, of course, as the Global Fund is not here for life, there's a big module that looks at building resilient and sustainable health and community systems, and then focused and comprehensive TB and drug-resistant TB and HIV case finding and prevention, critically looking at the missing TB cases and also on TB and HIV integration. So this is a proposal, and of course then there are cross-cutting areas where of course look at treatment, care and support for key and vulnerable populations, removing gender and human rights related barriers to accessing services, alignment, additionality and sustainability, and fostering leadership and accountability of level. This is a proposal that South Africa has submitted, and we are currently waiting for the first response from the Global Fund. But the idea is that on the first of April, we will have new principal recipients and we have new money in the country to actually add to the existing budget of the country moving forward. That is how far we are with the Global Fund. And then critical to us, as we mentioned, SANAC brings together the different sectors. One of the key sectors, and I'm happy we've got good representation here today, is the SANAC civil society sector, because government alone cannot drive this epidemic. So we need the voices of the people to drive the work forward. So we've got, in South Africa, we're one of the countries with a very robust civil society sector, whose real aim is to strengthen the civil society, HIV and TB response, and ensure that the civil society sectors are equal, meaningful and visible partners at all levels of the response. And the core objective of CSF is to provide leadership, coordination, support, political oversight and advocate for the development, monitoring and evaluation of the NSP. It's beyond that, but I've just picked up the key ones on why we have the SANAC Civil Society Forum. And also it's got representative leadership and resource mobilization. And Honorable Chair, I must mention that our civil society, I mean, most countries actually, they envy our civil society because even their elections are so transparent that they got presided to by the IEC. So Steve, as sitting here, she went through those elections and was elected, and the other sector leaders that are here, and they've got, and their term is aligned to the term of the NSP, meaning until 2022, then they will then have other robust elections for the civil society representatives for all the sectors. There are 18 sectors within the civil society. Sometimes I hear 19, but I always say 18. Yeah, it's 18 sectors, the different sectors that are there. But also, I've put in their resource mobilization. The SANAC Trust has worked very well with the civil society to even ask for resources to drive the NSP. I've put only two there, it's not the only one. But the National Lotteries Commission, we're able to raise 7 million working with the civil society, specifically to drive the campaign ways within the civil society from the National Lotteries Commission, working together with them to develop that proposal. But secondly, there is a program that was launched during the AIDS conference here in South Africa in 2016, what was called Special Hope, where the civil society actually launched a program to raise money to support the civil society. And, I mean, surprisingly, we started getting a lot of people pledging money into this fund. I mean, we've received money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has gone to the Positive Women's Network. We've received another $50,000 that went to NAPWA. We're expecting money from the World Health Organization. We're expecting extra money from the Department of Health for the Splash for Hope. And we then had individual people doing donations just to allow for the civil society to work. What is very nice about this is that our civil society is not only saying government need to fund our work. They are proactive to actually go out and actually look for funds to support the activities that they do. And linked to this, I've put in critically on stigma and discrimination, which is one of our goals, where the civil society has been very active in terms of driving this work. I mean, we've done stigma index in Mpumalanga and the Eastern Cape provinces, two districts in Mpumalanga, which is Gertsibande and Hlanzeni. Then in the Eastern Cape, it's Buffalo City and OR Tambo. And worked a lot with Legal Aid South Africa to address cases of stigma and discrimination. We've developed and implemented a stigma reduction and social change community mobilization model, advocacy material, and we've also done a huge human rights baseline survey. This survey actually helped us to actually write our proposal, because you know there is that dangling carrot, and our proposal needed to be strong on human rights. So this baseline survey was very critical to inform our global fund proposal. But since we were talking TB yesterday, we just thought that, I mean, in partnership with when we did the TB stigma, in partnership with those organizations, this is a kind of results we get in terms of stigma in the areas where we've worked. This is just a TB stigma. We have about 41.4 people who actually have been gossiped about, 36.3% who've been teased, insulted, or sonnet just because of having TB. And you've had 26.8% some that people were feeling that they are not clean or dirty. So there's quite a lot of work that we really need, and also we hope that the TB caucus actually is going to assist us to start addressing these issues in the constituencies in terms of the stigma. Because we've only thought of stigma when it comes to HIV. There's a lot of stigma when it comes to TB as well down in the communities. And then, Chair, through your permission, I'd like to hijack Reverend to take over on the National Wellness Campaign.
Good morning. Good morning once more. I'm going to quickly run through the National Wellness Campaign. The President made an announcement during his speech in Parliament that the country is going to launch a campaign in response to the growing epidemics of both communicable and non-communicable. And in response to this call, we made a presentation to the IMC for the launch of what we call National Wellness Campaign, with the following objectives: to provide an enabling environment for health-seeking behavior, to strengthen test and treat initiatives, to strengthen HIV prevention interventions, which includes condom use, medical male circumcision, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, PEP, PrEP, TB, hypertension, and diabetes mellitus communication. The campaign has the secondary objectives of increasing demand creation through community mobilization, to strengthen community testing, including HIV self-testing, to improve referrals for diagnosis, improve data collection. There are game changers. Chair and honorable members would recall that we had a similar campaign launched by the President in 2010, but this time around, there are game changers to the campaign in the sense that this one is a focus targeted in terms of population and geography to obtain high yield. We'll target the test averse and the untested, prioritize the high burden districts, which are 27, prioritize 22 Shikonka sub-district. That's all geographic testing. And then it includes intensified case finding for TB clients and non-communicable diseases case finding as well. These are the targets of the campaign, very ambitious, that between now and 2020, it aims to initiate 2 million additional new clients on treatment. And we'll do so by ensuring that annually, 14 million people are tested and screened for HIV, STI, TB, and 7 million of those for hypertension and diabetes mellitus, non-communicable diseases. I've already mentioned that it's going to be targeted in terms of geography. This is what follows. So 10 million of the 14 million in the 27 high-density district, high-burden district, So only 14 million of the 14 million will come from the 25 remaining. So it's very targeted. We're just trying to look at the Iverton district. And then, of course, intensify case finding. The package of services will include, amongst others, widespread distribution of condoms, promotion of HIV self-screening amongst vulnerable and key populations. I need to add here that self-screening is being introduced quite widely. It's at a pilot state, so it's not yet, in terms of government policy, being distributed at the moment, but it is being piloted at the moment. Then pre-exposure prophylaxis among populations and post-exposure prophylaxis. And of course the other target, package of services which you have mentioned about test and treat, making sure that there is a stronger linkages to care. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. So we've closed this with this presentation because it's forward-looking. This campaign was supposed to be launched in June, but then there was something that had it postponed. So we might be getting a date very soon where it will be launched and it will hit the ground running. But what's more critical is that it's going to be in each corner, everyone ensuring that everyone gets tested, because we do need to have the additional 2 million people on treatment by 2020. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Doc. I think we've taken a little bit of time in the presentation. I've allowed that because it's the first time in the 5 years of the term. And it's quite an interesting presentation and more empowering. I forgot to inform honourable members and guests that the gentleman who is standing requested to stand because he had a health condition that is allowing him necessitated him to stand. But I would appreciate if you can introduce yourself, because it's very important that you are known. Because some of the members were not in the launch, and some of the people.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm Nif van Dalf, a doctor, a national TB ambassador with my wife. We're at NDR-TB. I have latent NDR-TB myself, and I'm with a non-profit organization called TB Proof, and I'm also on the SANAC TB Civil Society Task Team. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Honourable members, we are now it's time for questions. I was just checking if there is lunch. I'm told there is none. So we are waiting from now until half past 12, 1 o'clock. So questions? Questions, comments, clarity, questions of clarity and comments. Side. Honorable Maisele, Honorable Gonzo, Honorable Mashelele.
Thank you, Chair. Well, thank you for interesting presentation. Well thought of and well presented and inspiring. I think we do understand that if you keep on doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different outcomes, there is something wrong. It's even worse if you expect the same outcomes. So we need to look into that and see how we can shift the paradigm and tackle the same problem, but expect some different outcomes which will be sustainable. We know that poverty is the greatest single
driver of ill health. It doesn't matter what you do. You can throw all the medicines and all the healthcare professionals into the arena, but you are not going to win if the subject is subject to poverty. And the reason why certain localities become more endemic in this type of things, let's say TB mining areas. By the way, we expect mining areas to be very rich places because that's where the riches of this country come from. It's ironic that the areas that produces the riches of this country are the poorest, okay, and they are subject to these pandemics, especially TB. And of course, HIV being maybe something that was very much scary, was concentrated on. And meanwhile, the greatest killer is TB. And maybe I was going to ask whether some of the findings that you have acquired, some can divert some of them to get the expert machine, gene expert machine, for diagnostic purposes. Because if you diagnose the TB earlier, you are, or any disease, if you catch it before it spread, the possibility of successful treatment are very high. So some of these things, if they can be expedited, then we make sure that almost every, or at least double the amount of number of people that you have been screening. The other people may not have the facility, but they may have the know-how or the will to do it. But if they don't have the equipment, they cannot do much, so on and so on. And we have a spike in teenage pregnancy, especially in certain areas, where, as you mentioned, it picks up because of hormonal problems. Mm-hmm. That drives them crazy, and they think they know. But all these things is based on poverty. It doesn't matter how poor you are. I mean, if you also have some form of protection, you can still survive. But if you don't have, and you're poor, and you're victims of the circumstances and the elements, then you can get all the doctors in the world to attend to you. You are dead. And it's even worse to keep you alive when you know that you're not going anywhere. You are just walking towards the grave. So that is scary. And you mentioned that we are, because of all these things, it must be that we are doing something wrong somewhere, or we are doing something that is not actually beneficial. We need to look at it, what it is that we are not doing successfully, or what it is that we are doing wrong. Because if you diagnose a disease, you can be able to find a cure. If you can't diagnose that, then you won't find a cure, that's for sure. But the correct diagnosis of the problematics leads to a correct solution to the problem. When we are working in silos as well, which is another thing. Maybe it's because of the socialization that we grew up under. We were taught not to work communally, think about ourselves, not about the community. So even in outside, they translate into working in silos. And that is what guarantees the defeat that we are suffering from. Intervention, like you said, which would be based on evidence, and before you can do your intervention, that is evidence-based intervention, is always better than just throwing in the thing, because something that can be done already. We used to do it this way. So I'm very impressed that we are beginning to think about just not doing things, but using scientific methods of doing things, not just because we can do them, but because they must be done in a certain way. So we should try to get to to work with, integrate our work instead of working in silos if we want to win. Now we know that the public health service or public health service which try to do intervention rather than curative is much more desirable. So if you can work with the public health professionals and of course try to get detection, early detection, our success rate of curing will be much more enhanced. But prevention is better than cure at any given time. But a nation that does not look after its children is not going anywhere. And we're talking about here, and everybody knows that the concentration must be in getting the children out of this dangerous zone, out of this danger zone. And if we don't do that, we're merely breeding a cesspool of infection. And the future is going to be very dim indeed if we can't look after our children and prevent them from falling prey of these two killers. And of course, they go in tandem. Where you find one, you must look for another one. They go together. And the other one, which has been neglected for a long time, is the greatest killer. So it's ironic that we concentrate on something that makes headlines, but something that has been a silent plague, that has been killing more and more people, has been neglected. And I think I'm happy that it's South Africa that found a expeditious diagnostic tool, which must be exploited. We should really be thankful that we were the people who came up with this and exploit it and use it effectively. Thanks.
Thank you, honorable members. That was not a good example. So can we, honorable Konzo?
Thank you, Chair. South Africa has the biggest HIV epidemic, estimated at 7.1 million in 2016. At the same time, South Africa has made progress in the last 10 years. What I would like to ask Sanek is about the two in relation to the provinces doing exactly the same what we've done nationwide. In other words, I'm sure the members, SANEC, understand what my question is. The SANEC is visible in provinces, visible in municipalities. I would like to know or to get to know successes in respect of those government structures or tiers in as far as the statistics are concerned. I'm asking this question because with the recent successes that inspire SANEC, we have HIV related deaths down, TB related death down, life expectancy up, HIV treatment up, new HIV infections down. If we talk that language in this, as far as the South Africa is concerned, if we could maybe be given the same kind of picture in these two areas, or because you are a national organization, maybe we could talk provinces, but I would be interested in districts as well. Western Cape and Northern Cape, Chair, they've got a good picture, you know, in terms of reports, you know, and your engagement demonstrated that. I mean, this is what they gave. I want to know, when did you realize that, or when did you establish that they are doing so well in the areas that you mentioned? I want to assume that you only got to know when you got there. I mean, when in your interaction or in your reports with them. My question would be, what was the report like before today? In other words, before you actually had interactions with them. SANEC is tracking its performance in one way or another, but how is it tracking its performance on the planned activities? And awareness and information sharing on HIV are critical for an HIV-free generation. What measures is SANEC playing to implement these? The allocation of funds received from the donors. Maybe I would like to know the allocation or the distribution of the allocation thereof in respect of the provinces, because if you talk South Africa, we talk provinces, and if we give reports, we are able to say this is how well we are doing. We have these challenges, we have these successes, but in turn we are able to translate the same provincially and otherwise. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let me also join colleagues to welcome the presentation. Well, I will start, Chair, by raising my concern. Well, my concern is in relation to the non-availability or attendance of the department as the key center, a driver in this work that we're doing. HIV and AIDS and TB. I'm not sure whether it's been an error on our side not inviting them to be part of this, or is them who decided to say, no, it's not our mess. Because I would have expected them to be part of this discussion as the department. So that the issue that Honorable Maisha were able then to identify whether it exists or doesn't exist. Currently, as we speak, in the whole presentation, except at the structural level, I could not locate the role of the Department of Health in the whole presentation. In all the spheres, not just at the national level, in all the spheres. In the whole presentation, I was trying myself to locate what is the role of the Department of Health in its totality. National, provincial, and at local level. I couldn't talk. I'm lying if I say going out here, I can say with authority that within the context of SANAC, this is what the Department of Health at the national, provincial, and at the local level is playing in an integrated approach. I couldn't find in the presentation of which for me that's a problem. That's a problem for me because I would have expected them to be here and the presentation should be in an integrated approach that begins to define in terms of their role as well in all the spheres. Of government. Well, I'll pass them. That's just my observation and that I've made here, and I will leave that. Well, coming to the issue that has been presented, well, the Honorable Maisela raised a very, which you also raised, Doc, in your presentation. The issue of poverty as the driving force of all the ills and the challenges that the country is confronted with. That includes your HIV and AIDS and TB. That issue that Honorable Maisel was raising around the integrated approach in comprehensively dealing with the issue of HIV and AIDS in a very comprehensive way. That begins to say, while it's a sexual matter, but it has got a lot of ills in society, which is your poverty, your inequality, your gender inequality, all those matters play into the space. And therefore, whatsoever plan that we come up, if it doesn't address that particular element, we'll put a lot of resources. But we're not going to yield the intended results because we're not addressing the comprehensive nature of the challenge that we're confronted with. I just want to understand the extent to which when we are engaging this donor funding, what is their focus? Do you extend it to also include these challenges that we're confronted with, poverty, unemployment? So that you are able while you intervene medically, but there should be these social needs that equally also get addressed. So that you are able then to deal with the challenges that results towards people finding themselves doing all sort of things that they're doing, which then lead them to contract this disease because of the social status in which they find themselves. And this donor funding also includes the issue of beginning to deal with the social ills that our society are confronted with. We have for the whole problem of the abuse of alcohol in the country. We are the highest drinker of alcohol here in South Africa compared to the whole of Africa. And dominantly are young people that you go into taverns in the evening, they're all over. If you go into townships, you will hardly find a street that doesn't have a tavern. You'll hardly find a street that doesn't have a tavern. And it's young people, male and female, and when they got drunk, they engage into sex activities, unprotected as it is. And then, as a result of that, then this becomes the outcome of this HIV and AIDS epidemic. And then the issue of early teenage pregnancy as well comes in. A whole range of these issues. And therefore, there has been I'm not sure whether you are able to engage trade and industry, because there's been a talk about trying to deal with this issue of trading licenses and reducing, because it does contribute. Because if you don't speak to them and show them the impact that alcohol is having on young people, which then also results towards the spread of this disease, nobody will be able to take this matter seriously. I'm not sure the extent to which you're engaging, because for the past 5 years, they've been talking about amending the legislation on trading of liquor and all those things, and they're not doing it. Because of the multinational companies who have got highly vested interest, because for them it's about making money at the expense of ordinary people. They don't care about it. But that people are dying and all those things, that's not there. As long as they're making money, for them it's fine. The other issue, Chair, just want to check. There is a view, I don't know how correct it is, that as a country we've become complacent around this issue of HIV. We become used to it. To such an extent that it's no more a topical matter. Just became used to it. It's no more a topical matter, and then the issue of prevention seems as if it's no more an issue, it's more about treating. Because I hardly hear now people talking about the ABC. The distribution of condom is obviously not working, because it's not giving the desired results. We need to sit down and say what is that must be done? Why is it like that? Because we're distributing billions of condoms, but the results, it's very limited. Even when we are engaging the Department of Health, they could not give us a comprehensive reason or having done a proper analysis as to why is it like that. Why people are getting used to condom to such an extent that they don't feel like using it. Because as you see with the rise of teenage pregnancy, it means young people doesn't see the reason for using a condom. Let alone the ordinary prevention measures, but just the one that has got to deal with their own health. It's not an issue for them. What is it? What is it that is not right. It's a moral problem. And then if it's a moral problem, what is it that we're doing to bring moral back to our society so that we're able to, because we can't devote it from moral regeneration, movement, and all things, how do you integrate that so that we begin to address this problem, the comprehensive. And then, unfortunately, the slide is not numbered, so I will have difficulty in referring to them. Except saying a slide that deals with this and this. There is this slide that deals with... I just read it. There are about 7.1 million people living with HIV and AIDS. And then out of them, only half of the people are with HIV are getting ART treatment. And then one in every four people who start ARV treatment are no longer on the treatment within a year of starting. And then take that with your 1990, 15 to 64 years of age line, and correlate the two. I'm trying to correlate them. Because as you're presenting, you're saying, no, we are closer to 99. I just want to make a correlation. I was reading it, I can't find the correlation. Coming closer and looking at the figures here, half of the people are on ARTV of the 7.1 million. But we've got a 87% written, that's what means we're saying we're closer to 90. While the 7.1 million, half of the people that are not on ARTV. I don't understand the correlation. I don't know, because 3 million of people who are on ARV, or 2 comma something, was half of, three comma something, was half of 7 comma, 3 comma something. And then that represents 50%. And therefore, 87 of the 70, of 7, because I'm looking at the original figure of the 7.1, which is the one that must tell us we're at 99. Because that's the total figure that we have. Not on the basis of those that are receiving. But that's how the target should be. It can't be on the target on the basis of those that we are giving ARV, while there's the 50% that we're not. And then we say, no, we're at 99. We're closer to 99. I don't understand. Maybe you would explain that to me. That applies to the same issue of 70% who are on treatment. Because 70% of the 7.1 million, which is 50% of those that are receiving, it can't be 70%. I don't understand this calculation. And out of that 3 comma something million, one in four are deserting the medication. So I was trying to read it to make sense out of it, I couldn't. You then assist me to have the better interpretation, because I found it not to be a correlation of the two when I look at it. Because we'll be going out and clapping our hands that we're doing very well, while when we're asked, no, how do you say you are closer to 99 when we've got 7, out of the 7.1, we've got only 3 something million that are on the treatment. We are not even above, we are not closer to 60%. But we're saying you are closer to 99, you are doing very well. I don't understand it. I would have understood it to be saying we're doing well when out of the 7.1 million, then what, we had 6 million. Then we're saying, no, we're getting closer there. Just that explanation is you also have to be, we've got the same interpretation of this matter. The other challenge that we know that Africans in particular, when they got sick, before they go to health facilities, they go to traditional healers. That's the reality of the situation. The last time I checked, research was saying about 60-70% of Africans, before they go into health facility, they consult traditional healers. For example, where I come from, there is a hospital that is called, people have even called it Mvakwako, because when you drop a patient and then you leave, after that they call you, say, Mvakwako shale wa shona. Then they call it Mvakwako, that hospital. But when you analyze deeply, why is this Mvakwako? When you analyze deeply, it's not the problem of the health system. It's the problem that people present themselves when they're about to die in the health system. Because they've been busy with traditional healers. When they're about to die, it's only then that they remember. By the way, there is a hospital, there's a clinic. Then they go there. And by the time, it's extremely very late for any medical intervention to be done. So how do you mobilize these traditional healers to be part of this bigger agenda? I don't know how, even if they, so that they are able to be able to identify, to say, no, this person, when you present to them, has got signs that might be of having the disease or HIV or TB, they are able to say, no, sibu referra especially with immediate effect, without maybe entering into more discussion. How to deal with that? So that they're able to mobilize this, because that's another problem. And then the other issue is the issue of, I know you're saying there's a high rate of females, young girls in particular, who are contracting. I'm sure that the male one doesn't. Because I'm raising this because in the context that the females ones are the ones that goes to health facilities. If you go into rural areas, you will hardly find in a clinic a male. They see these facilities as facilities for females. You will hardly find a man in a clinic. As we're doing oversight, honourable members will agree with me, wherever we're going in the health facility, 90% of the people that will find there were females, and a small section of males. And most of the time, they don't present themselves, they don't check their health status and all those things, like women does. Do we have a program to mobilize men to also know their status? Because that's why because once you focus on one set area and leave the rest, we're not going to be winning the, because this one will go and check, find a condition. This one doesn't, and amadoda ayabana babana machira mani. And then if they can't be able then to be pushed to continue to take their status, they will be able to be spreading this thing. And then, I don't know how we're managing it, because normally we normally say there's a few that know, I'm a blessers that are spreading this thing to these young guys and what. But I've seen in the rural areas, most of the kids that get pregnant at schools is their own counterpart at school. It's not somebody outside somewhere. That's the reality of the situation. And those boys have got many girls, not even one. But they don't go and check themselves. So I don't know whether you do have a program to deal with that particular issue. I know I'm not doing very well, Jim. Let me just go to the last two issues. And then Africans has raised this thing, but we want to understand the extent to which these eight councils, especially at the lower level, are functioning, are being supported financially and otherwise to be able to perform these tasks. Because I see if in your structure you go as far as the ward. I belong to your ward, but I don't remember in my ward having a ward 8 council. I don't remember that. I don't know how many wards have that. And if they do, to what extent are they functioning? At a local level, most of the municipalities are distressed, totally distressed, most of them. And therefore, to say they will perform this function, distressed as they are, they can't provide water. How sure are we that what support are they being provided? Because they can't even provide water. The basic thing that the ordinary community needs, they are able to provide it. That's why I've got service delivery protests all over, because of the failure of municipality to provide the service that is needed. Then you say they must then provide, they must have a local aid council to make it function and all those things, while they're struggling to have a functional ward committee, which is funded, some of them, by a co-opt, but they are not even able to make it work. How do we make sure that the local aid councils are able to function properly? And that includes your district. And then, what are the elements of the she campaign? Because we hear about it, but I'm not sure what's what. She conquered campaign. Now, what are the elements of it? And because we just heard about it in the streets, you know, and we are public representative. The first time I heard it when I was raising on a business day. That was the first time I heard. Oh, there's a program called She Conquers Campaign. Then I started reading it from the business day, and I ask myself how many ordinary people that, because the people that are affected, those are the poorest. someone, how many of them are understanding these things? Because it's peaked at the particular level that is not relating to, they can't relate with it, it's not closer to them. It's any language. Yeah, but the most people are affected, people are in the rural areas, in the townships, whatsoever program that we come up with must be able to empower them, and therefore it must relate to them. Like we're saying, in you can't implement something here in the city of Cape Town in the same way in the Northern KwaZulu Natal where you come from, equally in the deep eastern part of Mpumalanga where I come from. It's not practical. Nobody will understand you. How to make sure with whatever program, IEB is cool this thing. While ordinary people can't relate with it. Because if ordinary people would relate with it, it's not going to have an impact that we need, because these are the ordinary people that are affected by this. So whatsoever program that we come up with, it's be closer to the stage Salavant. And begin to relate with these ordinary people that are affected. Because I look at too much at the global level. Since homosh, and give figures and a lot of things without necessarily making the necessary impact that we need. Because there are many people in the rural area that are dying and in the township of these diseases, TB and HIV and AIDS. And then the out of the 7.1, you are giving half of them. Yeah, there were half of them are in the ARV. What is the plan to deal with those the remaining? Because you know that. Why are they not put in the system? Because they are known, I mean. Because I hear you saying, no, we must intensify this testing campaign and reach our 14 million so that we are able to get the 2 million. My understanding is that we already have the 2 million. Why don't put them in the system? Why do you still want to look? Because you're saying you have them. The 14 million that we will test it must be additional to what you have. But you should start putting those remaining, the half that you have not put in the system, to put them in the system. Instead of waiting for the testing for the 14 million to identify the 2 million, while Unayo already half of the 7 comma that you need to put into the system. And I would be saying, I thought you'd say, no, we've got 50% in the system of the 7.1, and then we are now in the process of rolling out and put the remaining, while you are identifying the others that you have not yet identified. But I get an impression that, no, you're saying we've got 7.1, 50% of them are on ARV. You still have to go for testing for 14 million to identify 2 million. Will a 14 longer in taste? While you've got half, will a 7 come that you have already in the system? That you're not talking about, when are you putting them in the system? Maybe I understood it wrongly, but I'll appreciate if you can just assist me.
No, thank you very much, members. My apologies on the noise and in a flow that I'm told within your jurisdiction over. Okay, so there will be that. Just few questions on my side. I think others have been asked. One, that you have got one person per province in the structure, in the composition of the CCM. How confident are you that they report? Are you able to check? I'm coming from the Eastern Cape, and I sit in the structure of the Eastern Cape in terms of the Party of Health. But I've never, ever, get a report. So I'm saying that's why I'm making that. Two, I see in the stats that it's got private sector, the Chamber of Mines, but in terms of the department, you don't have mineral resources. Because I, how then, because I would have thought that when you have got the Chamber of Mines, you will then have and you don't have, a person, I don't know whether, because it's under presidency, women, Department of Women. I'm very much interested in that. The funding of civil society, how confident you are that they are not vulnerable and being manipulated by people that are giving them money? I'm raising that because it has been my observation as an activist, first and foremost, health activist, that some of them, when they speak about, when they reflect about the failures of government, at times it's a bit unpalatable what they say. And I'm happy that the TAC here, and they go into a space, close into a space, which I would think that is a space for employer and employee. Say, go into labor matters. I would have thought that that if then they think that the labor community in a particular clinic is weak, is their responsibility to say to COSATU, please, rather than. So I'm just making that. But apart from that, I'm just saying, just in general, how confident are you that, because they do sit in the other things will just be about, I think one of them, I have checked Honorable Mahlalela, I'm told that, I think we'll have to make a follow-up onto that, that the department was invited to inform about this. Sex workers, is it fair, or is it not about time that will also reflect that in that space, it's not only women that are sex workers, it's men too. And it's alleged that that community is increasing. Is it because of the conservativeness of our society that everything, and because of patriarchy, that everything that is wrong, that is bad, is about how this woman conducts herself? And a structure of this nature, Doc, I think that it must assist the community too. So this thing of even in the SADA PDF, this thing was raised, and we must not sit and think that sex workers is only women. I wanted to raise that so that we are then able to, because our community is conservative. The issue of sex and sexuality and this thing of working in silos, it brings me to that. Do you have an ability and capacity as SANAC to just have a pilot, in particular in basic education? How are teachers relating with our way, our children and grandchildren, whom at the age of 10 are starting to menstruate, whom at the age of 11 and 13 are engaged in sexual activity. And I think Matlala is correct. I was taken aback in one region, I think it's Joka, the area, when I said, but who impregnate a 13-year-old? And the counselor said, you'd be so surprised. It's in the school, the peer group. And when I asked, why are they not using condoms? You know what was the response? No, they don't want, the boys don't want to use condoms because they said they're too big. That's what our communities in the deep rural areas are faced with. How then do we ensure? So we're asking these questions, we may be creating a burden to you, but you have got that responsibility of ensuring. This is a very important subject. We can be talking about, we can talk about ensure that our economy grows, but how are you going to grow economy when you've got a sick society? And structures of this nature working together are to ensure, and we may be raising difficult questions, maybe without hope, but these are public representatives, it's what they are supposed to be doing. But the community that all of us and the society that all of us are faced with, that it is a society that is conservative. It is a society that is patriarchal. It is a society that class divides. In my other deployment, when I was once the national treasurer of Nehau, the leader of tech came to us, try and at the time that there was an issue of treatment and nutrition. I'm happy that you have raised the social economic challenges. I said to Mark, you know, I'm listening to you. You're talking about treatment. As a health worker, you can't talk about treatment outside nutrition. You can't talk about treatment without a decent house. You can't talk about treatment without ensuring that in our public. So it's a whole. I think as you move forward, I hope as you move forward, this coordination of all these departments that are key, because it will never be a response. And I'm happy that you have raised them here, but I just wanted to talk. I think we have, those are the, the last question is, have you ever interacted with the community of higher education? But in the center of all that talk, in me stepping down, I am a bit worried because every person who speaks, in particular in the higher education community, kukhulunywa ingathi abantwana bazelwe ziyunivesities. People speak as if everybody, civil society, everybody, the role of government, as if these people were born, these children are born by universities. I'm making an example. Those children are not born by universities, and therefore the importance of a basic unit of the society, which is a home, and the role of parents in this 21st century. Which parents now, as parents, we have abdicated our responsibility as a teacher. Whereas the informal education that makes me to be who I am starts at home. And as SANAC, with all this loaded responsibility, do you have a program of ensuring that now as parents and grandparents, my worry is that we are where we are because of that informal education at home. Why at the time that we are parents, there is this 18-year-old, a 15-year-old is roaming around in the street with a bottle of beer? Why is it that you can't, as a parent, say no? Because when I was a pupil at the time, if you roam around in town at 12 midday, you were asked by a parent that you have never, you don't know from a bar of soap, why are you here? And you have to produce a permit from school. If you don't have that permit, you know. Ekhaya, uhleli usoyika because there's going to be somebody who, what has happened? So I'm saying, as we are looking into some of these things, we must look into the brother, as Honorable Mashalela, he said, what has gone wrong? Is it the normal fiber of the, what is it? If it is the impact, the impact of the high rate of unemployment. So I'm raising this because the role of the conservativeness of that sector, the religious community. So your expression that is to talk with us on issues that we are afraid to talk about, because this is a ticking time bomb. Unless and until the African people, the black people, stand up and talk. I don't know what is happening in other races, but I do think that as a black, I'm talking from experience, as a black mother, as a black child who grew up in a home that was very conservative, how then do we ensure? And I do think that maybe the presidency would then have to assist all of us. So those are my few questions and comments. And I think Honorable Mashalela is correct. Mobilization of men is very important. But the issue of a boy child, I always get worried, and I'm happy that you have put that. I always get, even us as activists, we talk as if we want to build a better society, gender is about a male and a female. And therefore, the issue of a boy child, where do we start about? So I do think that I'm happy that you have raised those. We are going to break for just a comfort break. The comfort break is allowing you to see to sort out who's going to respond on this and whatever. Then we'll come back and get a response from you. Thank you very much. So that we are able to, I'm waiting for you to finish your conversation. Zagotha, Zagotha, Utetifoni. Zagotha, Utetifoni, Utetifoni, Zagotha. We are now going to get responses from Sana. Then after that, so that I don't forget, after that, when we are done with our, I'll just request the members of the committee to remain for our housekeeping. But now let's get how you respond. We will, it depends on you who is going to do what and whatever. The only thing that I forgot to reflect is that unfortunately we don't have a translation thing here. We may have said some of the things that some of our guests may not have picked up. So that's the unfortunate part. I'm reminded about this when Honorable Mashalela said that men have got too many cherries in a Kasili language. And I could see that other people, they do understand what he was saying. But they may have been some other things. So our apologies about that. And when Sanak will then be responding, maybe we'll be able to cover that gray area where at times we use vernacular. Over to you, Doc.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members. how I wish we got these questions before we came in here, because we would have done our presentation in a different way. but at least now it will make it easier the next time, because now we know exactly how the committee wants our presentations to be structured. But
a community that is very vulnerable, farm community. How do you ensure that provinces are able, sorry for that. If you can also reflect on that, thank you. Workers, schools, and the attitude of farmers in terms of, if you want to, because remember that it's a private property, but thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Would like maybe firstly to start back in, maybe we did not go deeper into explaining the structure of SANAC. In terms of the bigger structure of SANAC, we've got 18 civil society sectors, which include traditional leaders, traditional healers, women, labor, sports, art, sports, culture and recreation, the religious sector. So all these sectors have got the leadership that gets elected and participate. I did not mention all of them, but it's a wide representation. People living with HIV, they are part of the sectors. But in government, we've got 22 core IMC departments that participate within SANAC. So there is this robust communication throughout SANAC with the main departments that are involved, which includes, of course, minerals and others. But I'll talk about the CCM, because the chair's question was specifically on the CCM, not in the bigger SANAC structure. But also, secondly, maybe I did not say this, SANAC is not an implementing agency. SANAC is a coordination structure at a national level. So what actually SANAC does, maybe that will answer Ubabu Mhlonishwa Mahlalela's question. We actually collate and ensure that people do what they do, either in government or in the civil society or in the private sector. When we're doing a presentation there and talking about TB and talking about treatment, that's the Department of Health. PrEP, ensuring that there are test kits, testing, procurement of gene experts, which, by the way, we put in a lot of money from the Global Fund to roll out gene experts in the country, which Global Fund is managed at SANAC. So we're talking here on what each role player in the country is doing. So we're just the mouth of what the Department of Health has achieved, and we coordinate, we hold them accountable in terms of what they should be doing. Same with Department of Basic Education, same with Department of Higher Education, which I will talk about, as the chair has mentioned. So I thought maybe I need to start on that one. And then on the second one that I would like to talk about is the HIV statistics. This is sometimes they can be very confusing. Firstly, HIV is not a notifiable disease. So HIV statistics, that is why we will always say estimated, because that's literally based on modeling. And modeling, it depends on what model we're using, but we've agreed as a country currently that we're using a Tembisa model, which is run by the teams from University of Cape Town, that we report on mostly. But you've got UNAIDS who use totally different modeling method, not very different, but they use the spectrum, and then you've got the others that use the ASA model. It's a bit of an older model. So you do your research, and I must say that the research, actually, most of it, like HSRC and them, is actually community surveys. that go into households. So it's not like they take people from the clinics. But for the Department of Health, the annual seroprevalence survey, they say, well, that one is specifically for women who are pregnant and are attending antenatal clinics for the first time. But when we talk HSRC, we talk the others, they are community surveys. And those community surveys are cross-sectional most of the time. But you do have some longitudinal surveys in some corners of the province. Now, longitudinal is actually where they follow a cohort of people over a long term. Those are mainly common in the Hlabisa area, done around Africa Center, where they have a cohort. And those are actually much more bit accurate in terms of incidence, because if I take a cohort of 10 people, I work with them and I test them every year. Every year, by the time I come to the 10th year, I can tell you that out of these 10, 4 got infected over a 10-year period, and that's an incidence. It's either, but they are not easy to do. They are not easy to do. Now with the other new ones, now they can now use some new biomarkers. By new biomarkers, I mean the tests that can actually tell you if you. I mean, if you test me today with a conventional test and I'm positive, you can't tell me whether I got infected 15 years ago and I got infected 6 months ago. But some of the newer tests that are used, that are new in the market, they are now able to tell you that this infection might be this old. You can tell this person is recently infected and all of that. Yeah. So that's what gets done. So coming to the statistics, they are estimated, now to be specific for Mahlalela, the estimated is now 7.8, because it should be 7.1, is estimated based on modeling. Based on the modeling that has been done, based on the particular tests that were done, then they can model and say, this is what it means for the country. It's tried and tested, it's an accepted method. So that's why we always say, people, you always say estimated. However, we know that out of those people, so I'm going to cover and say, this 7.1, we don't know all of them, because it's an estimated. We can't go and say, 1, 2, 3, kanjalo. You cannot, because it's an estimated. Until they come to us, so we know that there are those that we need to go and get. They are actually infected in terms of statistics. So that is why then the Honorable Reverend is talking about this active case finding of us going out, and because we know that there are people that are infected outside there that we don't know, that even themselves they don't know. They're a bit confusing, the statistics, but that's the only methodology you can use if you have it's unlike listeriosis. Now it used to be not notifiable, or let me talk polio, the easy one, that is polio. Polio can always at any given point in time, because by law, if you diagnose polio, you must notify it. But it's not the case, because TB was notifiable long before we were born. But they still don't notify it in the clinics. They diagnose TB and not notify it. Yet it is law. Actually, health workers, you should go to court if you don't notify it. So it's law to notify disease that is in the list of the notifiable diseases. But with HIV, because it's not notifiable, it's very difficult to always have accurate numbers. Hence, you rely a lot on research. Now, linked to that, I'll try and take those that are treatment-related or medicine-related altogether. The 1990 is cascades. That is, you might have, you're saying if you have 7.1 million or you have estimated 7.1 or estimated 7.8 million, you are saying if we want to make a big difference, at least 90% of those must know their status. And you say, now you're talking on the 90 of the 90. The 90 of the 90. So it's not the 90 of the first 90. It's a cascade. Actually, I was trying to look at something now. I couldn't find it quickly. So by the time so if you're saying it's about 50% that are on treatment, that know their status, your second 90 is already talking of that 50%. Or even if it was 40 or 60%. So that's why it's called a treatment cascade, because a cascade is something that goes like this. So unfortunately, that's how it's actually been set up to work on. And then secondly, the one I would like to come on is the second one that I want to come on is the issue of, so that I don't lose myself, is the issue of teenage pregnancy, the issues of poverty. It came from Bobma Iseng, and how do we deal with those issues that are actually social disease drivers around pregnancy. But I'll do that together with the, I will do that one together with the She Conquers campaign, because they talk to each other. She Conquers campaign is a campaign that was launched 2 years ago. It's a three-year campaign, and it's got five objectives. It brings together all programs that are addressing young and adolescent girls in the country. With the, it's got five objectives. One is to reduce the HIV infection rates in the young girls. Two is to reduce teenage pregnancy. Three is to keep girls in schools, at least up to matric, because it's known, it's evidence-based that the school is protective if they at least stay until matric. Four is to reduce gender-based violence. Five is to increase economic empowerment opportunities. That's why I wanted to bring it now. Then the economic empowerment opportunities. There is actually a study that was presented where they show that condom usage amongst the young and adolescent girls actually can be increased if they can be provided with some economic means. That means the lesser economic means they have, the more exposed they are to not using the condoms. Hence, there's a program that we are piloting here in the Western Cape and in KwaZulu-Natal. It's called a Cash Plus Care program. Cash Plus Care program. I will allow Dr. Slingers to talk on it a bit at a later stage. While we're piloting this program, we're actually targeting 30,000 young girls, and then we want to evaluate it and see, because we're now implementing what we're seeing on that study. But it's looking mainly at issues of entrepreneurship, of providing some basic necessities to the young girls so they are not exposed, and also just ensuring that they have access to more economic opportunities. We're targeting 10,000 young girls here in the Western Cape, done through the department and the University of Cape Town Desmond Tutu Foundation Center, and the other one is in KwaZulu-Natal in King Cetshwayo District, where we're targeting 20,000 women, and we want to evaluate it so that we can see if it's feasible to roll it out. Because honestly, some of these young girls, if you really learn how vulnerable they are, some of them, it's a matter of life and death. They are in tertiary institution, or they are outside there. They really have nothing. Then they are then vulnerable. So we're doing this so that we can maybe have something scientific. But I'll allow Dr. Slingers at a later stage just to talk about it. So those are the five aspects of the Cash Plus Care. I mean of the She Conquers campaign as it was established long time ago. And I must say, it's really to get to what Bob Marshall was saying. It's really being done into the, I mean, if you talk King Cetshwayo District, you're talking areas like Nkandla, Kwambonambi, Eshowe, up towards, those are the deeper areas, because, and then here you're taking a bit of a city area and a deep, deep rural area. It can tell you if it can work. You've got really a very good mix of the areas. And we're actually doing it through the Global Fund, and it's one of the big programs that we are piloting in the country moving forward. And then there was then a question on provinces and municipalities, the Western Cape and Northern Cape. Probably English let me down here, I didn't put it properly. In the statistics, what I was saying was, in terms of the HSRC survey, the Western Cape and Northern Cape are the two provinces that are worrying because they've increased the prevalence. Unless if they've done so well in putting so many people on treatment, who have kept them in. However, I think I do get the request from the members that in our next presentation, we can have a much more broken down statistics up to the district level, because we have that available. Actually, the team under Sis Nolwazi, the SI team, we are currently working out provincial profiles with each of the districts using the latest data, so that we want each mayor, for example, when he's sitting, he can see, he can look, okay, these are the people I have in the district. In this district, I've got, if I've got five local municipalities, this is what is happening, this is the positivity rate, these are people on treatment, this is what is happening. But we want something live that can be updated as well, moving forward, so that there are tools that you can go to a lot. So far, for now, we can probably only go up to the district level. To the what level, it will be difficult, as Bab Marshall was saying, there's a lot of capacity issues when you go beyond the local municipality level, moving down. And then on tracking performance for planned activities, the Sonic Trust has got an APP which gets approved by the board, and it is actually reported on a quarterly basis, and at the end of each financial year, again, we produce an annual report which is on the website, which goes through our audit and risk committee. It can show exactly the performance versus what was planned in our annual performance plan, in terms of the key activities that we suppose to be doing. I think I've spoken about the role of the Department of Health, that actually what we've presented here, it covers everyone. Actually, mostly it's from the Department of Health in terms of the performance of the work that that they have done. And then the issue of leak and all the other issues that were raised, actually that's why it's very critical that we've got all the government departments, because actually if you look at the NSP, I think we made a mistake. We should have brought the whole set of that, because it's actually very specific on the activities. It puts who is responsible. So, for example, issues of liquor. One key issue about liquor is that licensing of liquor outlets is it's an exclusive provincial competence in terms of the constitution. But of course, DTI is critical, because it's a DTI matter, which is why then the premiers, as the chairs of the provincial AIDS councils, when they actually prepare these PIPs and break down issues around goal 4, which would include alcohol abuse, premiers should take responsibilities with their MSCs for economic development, who actually give out these licenses, to say, how are they going to address this issue of giving out the license? I know how then they were taking something up, but not really from our side. But this multi-sectoral aspect is very critical, and we're happy this is being raised, because we're noting it down, that when we actually assess some of this provincial, especially in places like, I mean, we all know that the bigger problem when it comes to liquor, because of the fetal alcohol syndrome, is the Northern Cape. Is there are, then followed by Cape Town here. So those provinces, you know that there's quite a bigger issue around those areas, and we should be checking specifically their plans. Do they talk to issues on managing liquor, but also the issue of law enforcement services as well, in terms of liquor hours, the unlicensed liquor units, and all of that is something that is very critical. And then issues of the role of municipalities, again, when it comes to all these issues, is very critical. And recently, SALCA has joined SANAC as a member. And we're actually in the last part of this month, we have a very big meeting over 2 days with SALCA, bringing in the mayors, and we're starting with at least 19 municipalities that we call fast-track municipalities, where we're going to be working out on a key programs for those municipalities, where there are some resources that we're getting from the UNAIDS and from IPEC, from another international organizations, to put in some fast-track programs in problematic municipalities. And why this is important is because we really, most of our normal or mainline funders, they're all more interested in biomedical issues. So if we do get areas where we can actually spend more money on these social and structural drivers that address all these, something that we call social determinants of diseases, we can be able to address it. So we will be working hard with them, with these municipalities, to start addressing the issues where they have specific responsibility. However, we've seen in municipalities where there is leadership that despite the lack of resources, there are municipalities that are doing very well, because remembering that HIV, it's not that much of their constitutional mandate, But if there's very good leadership and actually they call it mainstreaming, proper mainstreaming and in those areas, we could be able to actually reach quite a lot of returns in terms of the money. So in our role in coordination is to ensure that at a leadership level, which is why I was mentioning that we are now developing this tool for mayors, that when a mayor is sitting, even if per month, can just look at what you have. Because there are simple things like, in any municipality, you know how many schools you have. Mm-hmm. And you have statistics how many teenage pregnancies you have. You can actually work against to say, if this year I had so many teenage pregnancies, I must actually keep people accountable that how do we decrease next year. You know how many liquor outlets are there, what programs you put in place. So it's simple issues that you can actually work on in moving forward. And then there was the issue of the councils, the functioning, and how they're supported financially. This is very fortunate because in the first plenary of the chair that we had on the 29th of June, that plenary, the main issue of the main agenda item was for each of the premiers to present how their council is structured, how it's supported, how it's, so we have that report and we can make it available because the province is presented. Because we actually wanted it to come from the premiers themselves, not from what we've done in terms of the analysis of the provinces. So we do have it, they say it from the horse's mouth, and it's in a report of our AIDS Council, and that report we can make it available. And I must say, of course, it's differing in different provinces. There's some provinces that really they are spending good resources, they've budgeted, they've got staff. There are those that they only depend on the staff because we do provide one staff member to each of the provinces from SANAC to ensure that they are strengthened. So we can provide that report as a separate report to the Secretariat. And then there was an issue about the mining. Yes, we do agree. The minister always mentions the eight areas when he talks about the problematic areas when it comes to highest keeping. He will tell about Lejo Lepusa in Welkom, he will tell you about the West Rand, he will tell you about the Platinum Band Belt, he will tell you about that water bank. So there's quite a number of them. And there is actually forecast attention to the mines in terms of addressing critical TB, because we know that it's three times in terms of the incidence per 100,000 population of the people that have TB in the mines. And we do have a specific program, though it's a regional program, but South Africa is participating. It's called TIMS. It's a TB in the mines program, which is funded by the Global Fund. It's run through Vets Health as a principal recipient, and it's in 10 countries. And the main focus of that project really is to actually work in the mines and around the peri-mining areas. But just to address issues of TB in the mines. But again, we will understand that TB in the mines is beyond just implementing health programs, because at the end of the day, when people get down there, the ventilation is a big issue, so we need to ensure that there is pre-screening, and also people who contracted TB could be able to be exposed in terms of OD-WMA, the act there to get their compensation and all the issues around that. But we work very close with the mine people, let me just put it that way, in terms of addressing TB in the mines. So the mines, the correctional centers, are our core centers that we really spend so much time on, which is why now we spend a lot of money on the GeneXpert rollout, but we now, even with the coming grant for the Global Fund, we're actually putting in the issue of digital x-rays, that we now want specifically because the healthcare professionals, which is part of the sector that we have, is a very vulnerable. That's why you've seen doctors, you've seen nurses suffering. So we want to put this in now and have digital x-rays that are easy to diagnose and pick up issues. And we're going back to also ensuring that the whole issue of medicals, pre-employment medicals, periodical medicals, and all those medicals that you do in terms of occupational health and safety, we are able to address all those. So through the Global Fund, because what's not with the Global Fund, it actually allows you to try a lot of new things and get quite a lot of new technologies. Actually, just to share with the House now, one of the issues that the minister spoke about, there's a new drug that that's going to prevent HIV, TB in HIV positive patients. We've been using INH only, but now it's going to be INH and rifampicin, but it's not registered as yet. Dr. Slee asked to the college when it's together, it's 3HP. As soon as we've budgeted for that, we've been forward-looking. We've put it in our Global Fund proposal. We want it when once it gets approved as a drug and it gets rolled out, we have Global Fund mandate because government won't be ready because government budgets on a MTF. But we will be ready to kickstart that program because we're forward-looking and we know that it's much more effective as compared to just using INH only moving forward. And then on the CCM structure, the provincial people, I think I will agree with the chair. I will just share a story that in Amsterdam we met with the provinces and some ministers to present the Global Fund. Ministers and provinces to present the Global Fund proposal. Ministers and provinces were raising their hands and they were saying, we don't know about this as provinces. Who sits? We say, but we've got your people. And for us, they represent the province. So if the province sends the wrong people to come and sit in the CCM structure, that is a problem of the province. But at least after we're starting to hear now that they want to now get the people. Because, for example, the people that sit in the CCM structure from all the provinces are the people in premier's offices who sit in the provincial councils on AIDS. I mean, who are actually the heads of secretariats. Like the head of secretariat from the Eastern Cape AIDS Council to address the chair specifically is the person who sits on behalf of the Eastern Cape. And it is our assumption that because they actually represent the province, the constituents, that there is a mechanism of reporting back. As much as any person who represents people living with HIV, it is their responsibility to report back, but also to get inputs so that they carry the voice of that constituency when they come to the meeting. So that is what we always try and push for, but sometimes it's difficult. One thing I even raised with some of the ministers was that they also need to be able to send someone senior enough who's got a broader view of a department of departmental programs. You see, if you send someone who only works in HIV, who's in a corner there, deputy director, I will tell you when that person comes to the meeting, just because Department of Health is represented by a DG in that structure, we understand government. Once a DG has spoken as a deputy director, you can't challenge. It's a very hierarchical structure. So those departments who have very senior officials in the CCM, they have an advantage in terms of their programs getting much more input or getting much more money in terms of the CCM moving forward. And then in terms of the civil society, Chair, I think the first point I would say, and their vulnerability, the first thing I would say is that the participation of the civil society, anyway, participation in SANAC is voluntary. And the participation of the civil society in SANAC does not take away their independence. They have their independence in terms of, in terms of going out and looking for, specifically because from SANAC, we hardly fund the civil society. So they go out and get the funding based on that. But we always believe that as professionals, when they get the funding, they've got their own rules, and most of them have got their boards. They've got boards, they've got audit and risk committees, and they report to their boards that they deal with it. So as SANAC, really, it's not a structure that then says you can't do this because you're part of SANAC. You can't do, but we're trying to bring them together. Actually, I think SANAC has done so well in the past 10 years to bring civil society closer that it's actually easy to work together. We at least we walk in the similar direction. Of course, there might be those there and there, but we don't have a right to impose. Yeah, they'll make it possible that way to impose on them because they're an independent organization, independently registered. However, what we know is that if obviously there are some funds that probably get that get mobilized through SANAC to them, obviously they've got rules and things that they need to work within them. But if they've really gone out wherever and got the money, we don't even know. It becomes a bit difficult. I'm not sure if I've been able to answer that very well, Chair. And then in terms of sex workers, just to assure the Chair, actually the sex worker representative in SANAC is a male. So we are quite aware and we are quite progressive. So we are moving with that even at a representation level. And he talks for both. And he always says exactly what the Chair is saying, that sometimes you forget that as men we can be sex workers, transgender can be sex workers, so everyone can be a sex worker. So we are quite ahead on that one. When it comes to Department of Education, I would say in South Africa, Department of Education, probably it has not been presented here, but in some of the programs that we can work on, maybe when we get a chance for the next presentation, we actually in South Africa run one of the strongest Department of Higher Education AIDS programs. It's called HEAIDS, and it's in all 26 universities, and more than 50 TVETs, which have more than 300 campuses. And actually, Minister Pando and Deputy Minister Manamela, they are quite very active. I mean, they've run a program called First Things First. They've got other parts. Also, even with PrEP, the rollout of PrEP, that's why we've been able to roll out the pre-exposure prophylaxis to all the tertiary institutions. However, we will actually work with them to ensure that, how do we ensure that parents are critical at all levels of education, because those are the first educators, and they will remain educators to their child at whatever level moving forward. Then coming on the farm workers, yes, we do have programs on farm workers and farming areas, and those are the two issues I would like Dr. Flingers to speak on, just to touch a bit on the Cash Plus Care, and also touch on the farm workers program that we fund through the Global Fund in the different areas of the country. However, because this is maybe the last time I'm talking, is to ask the Chair that we have a lot to present, but we couldn't just put it all in one presentation. Thank you.
Doc, are you going to respond?
To talk about the Cash Plus Care, where this program really started was that Social Development came to SANAC and said that they are aware of the child support grant ending when a person is 18. And they're aware that women 19 to 24 or 20 to 24 are vulnerable. And there is evidence that the child support grant makes a big difference. But the initial feeling is what should be done for 20 to 24 year olds, because they are vulnerable, but there's no grant that covers that area. And they're also aware that evidence showing that people need not only money, but they need something else. So what is that about? So there was quite a lot of discussion with Treasury before this Cash Plus Care pilot was taken on, to understand that it is not setting up an expectation that government can't meet, but National Treasury themselves are also very interested in what kind of support can government give. I think the idea of the Cash Plus Care is being, in piloting it, we're already discovering feedback from the women in that age group that the financial challenges are a lot bigger than or larger than we thought, as people have been talking about the poverty and the social structural issues. I think that that's all been confirmed by the rollout of this Cash Plus Care program. The program is basically about the care element is about looking at giving people information that is obviously appropriate for their age and linked to what interests them. So it's about information, it is about offering support, it's about understanding what their needs may be, identifying those most vulnerable, linking them to the kind of services that they require, and then providing basic SRH services or linkages, and also a package that looks at HIV, TB, and sexually transmitted infections. Then the other element is looking at building economic opportunities. So it's taken quite a lot of time to understand exactly how to do that, because people struggle to understand how can you deliver it, and obviously there is some variability according to the area that you're focusing on, what people's needs would be and also what works for them. So for example, saving clubs in some areas work well and in other areas they don't. But the basic idea is to give women basic financial literacy. So it is how to budget, how to work with money, how to think about money. Then it is about linking people to three kinds of opportunities. The one is to link people to jobs. So it's about developing CVs, preparing them for interviews, preparing them for understanding what work is about, looking at internship opportunities, job opportunities. The second one is about trying to link people to opportunities for further education if they want that. Obviously, with the new NSFAS availability of funds, this has supported that. But it's understanding, helping people to understand how the system works, how to register, who qualifies, because not everybody will qualify for further education. The last element is about linking people to entrepreneurship opportunities and understanding what that is. I think that there's still quite a lot of work being done, and that is not fully developed, that part of the program yet. It's because it's understanding what drives entrepreneurship. I think there's quite a lot of information most recently coming out on who is actually attracted to entrepreneurship, and it shows that some of the assumptions that people made, that anybody can become an entrepreneur, is not actually true. So there's quite a bit of work in that area, and I think what we've learned with the first bit of the pilot is understanding that although there are quite a few government interventions out there for people, it's not coordinated and it's very specific. So we've actually focused on where the Global Fund programs are, trying to do an assessment of what is this, so that we start by utilizing best what government is already providing. Then the other element, which is the cash, it is an incentive based on the fact that people must attend certain sessions. So the sessions where they provide the care is the session that you must attend to be able to get the funding. And the thinking there is that it's not huge amounts of money. It's the two different government departments have chosen slightly different ways of doing it. It is 300 rand a month, so it's not a huge amount of money, but it is dependent on you coming and attending the sessions. The sessions, I should also say that they've been adapted and improved as you go. So you get a lot of feedback from young women to say, what do you want more of? And there's a big focus on making sure that it is youth-friendly and not outside of what they are looking for. So apart from the fact that the Cash Plus Care is being piloted, I think we're learning quite a lot about the women, what they're looking for, what they need, and also what the communities are thinking in this process. So there was an initial assessment, and that has been used for the next grant to look at what things need to be improved. And a lot of the issues that people have spoken about are the information about condoms. You know, people are saying that, yes, we know that they are there, but there are challenges about using them. So what are we going to do about that? So I think the Cash Plus Care is giving you information as you go, and it's giving you information from women in that area and it's giving you localized information as well. And that also, I mean, that links to my second point that Dr. Buthelezi asked me to deal with, is the issue of what services happen for farm workers. What we're trying to do is, you'll see in the National Strategic Plan, it says that a key strategy for working out what people need where is what we call the focus for impact. So we're trying to help provinces understand exactly where to focus, what the gaps are. So the focus for impact consists of three main elements. The one is a web-based platform that is set up to draw information from different information sources together. So that when you look at where your people, where in your province is the greatest need, you're not only looking at health information, but you would be able to look at social development information, basic education information to give you a rounded picture. We have just started this process, and we've launched the platform, and we've been working with KZN and Western Cape, and I can give you examples of how they have used it. Another element of the program is community profiling. So working with the community. So once you've identified areas that are high burden, and remember that this allows you to go beyond saying that this is a district with a high burden. It allows you to look exactly which ward in that district is the challenge. Then you work with communities to understand what are the drivers and what are the gaps that are not obvious. An example I think that is used by a lot of people is that some communities say that we focus on where there's virginity testing. They find that a lot more anal sex happens because people can still be a virgin, but they are having sex. But they're not aware of the fact that anal sex is more risky in terms of HIV transmission than vaginal sex. So unless you know that from the community and you raise the awareness then about that, you're not going to be able to truly address the issues. So the first, as I said, the focus for impact is first about understanding where your burden is, then getting community profiling, and then the third point is actually understanding what kind of programs you need to provide to the populations that you have at risk in that area. So how do you put the last picture together? And so the responses for farm workers is that we need each province and each district to understand where their need is. Do they have farm workers? And then you have to engage with that group to understand what those challenges are and how they'd like to see the service provision. Obviously, it's a difficult task because we are trying to bring about a paradigm shift of how people do services. So people have in the past only provided, you know, you have your list of 10 prevention programs and your treatment programs, and I'm just going to give the same thing everywhere. So we're trying to move people to an understanding that for the greatest impact of your funding, because you always have limited funding, is you need to understand your people, you need to understand the burden, and then you need to understand what people, how people in that area are thinking and what their needs are. And you need to target and I suppose make sure that services are targeted and special for those, for the people in that area. I think in some ways it is in the NSP when we talk about key populations, we talk about services that are targeted and customized. So I think we're trying to move to give people the information, as our CEO said that the Strategic Information Unit is working with provinces and districts to understand what that is. Then the community profiling is another layer. And then it's about shaping the programs for the people, which, as I say, is quite different from what people have done before. And people need to accept that then for farm workers, you need to understand, are they there the only seasonal? Or are they all the time? What are the local challenges? How do you address those local challenges? As you said, farmers, it's private land. You can't go on there and do what you want to do. So how do you engage? How do you bring the private sector along? So it's kind of driving how people operate and that's also having an added effect on improving how wards and local AIDS councils operate. Because the one thing you're going to have to do is turn around and say, actually, I can't sort this out on my own. You're going to need the multi-sectoral response to be able to do that. Thank you.
I don't know, Doc, whether it you have responded. In listening, you have responded to all our, you've covered all our areas, including comments. So I think by the looks, members themselves are also comfortable about that. Is there any area where you like, presidency?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'd just like to make a proposal and recommendation to the Portfolio Committee for consideration through your permission. So the Deputy President convenes what we call an extended SANAC plenary twice a year. We just had one now, 29th of June. We'll have another one sometime in November. I was wondering, Chair, if it wouldn't be a good idea for the Portfolio Committee actually to be invited to attend and participate in an extended SANAC plenary. Because that is actually a broad platform of dynamic engagement by all key stakeholders, civil society, business, government through ministers and safety ministers. In fact, premiers are also invited, they participate in the extended SANAC plenary. And they come with their delegations, which include MECs of health and civil society members from those provinces. I just need to put this to the Portfolio Committee Chair as a proposal that maybe we could extend an invitation through the Chair to the Portfolio Committee to actually participate in these two key sessions. It only happens twice a year. Because I think it would be very beneficial to both SANAC and its work, but also to the Portfolio Committee itself. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. When we are dealing with our House, but by the looks, I think its members are amicable to that proposal, but we'll process it accordingly with the... First, I want to thank every... Okay. Is there something you want to reflect on?
Yeah, well, sorry, Chair. In fact, initially I wasn't planning to make any input. However, I think when a member of parliament or a member of the committee requested just a bit of information earlier, it's necessary that I make that comment. First, to say, Chair, the Civil Society Forum, which is an integral part of SANEC, as the CEO had indicated. It's a formal advisory body that was established in 2012 because there wasn't any forum where civil society comes together. And Chair, you would know that in this country we have quite a substantial number of NGOs, civil society, community-based, faith-based, many that are registered, you know, under social development and also DTI through the CIPC process. And as CEO had highlighted, we have 18 sectors. So the forum itself is also in various spheres, not only just at national level, but also at provincial level, district level, and so forth, particularly because of the bottom-up approach that we took as a council in 2012 when we revitalized our own governance as a council. So the accountability as civil society, so as a chairperson, you would have chairperson of provincial forums in which then they become the co-chairs of provincial AIDS council, because SANEC is a multi-sectoral body. It's not a government body. It is a multi-sectoral body that is chaired by the deputy president and bring premiers and many others in various stakeholders to account, coordinate, and monitor the HIV response. So I think that is necessary to always remind ourselves on those bases. I want to also say that without just looking at it as a gloom process, there was a question around funding, which the CEO had also articulated about the independency and the autonomous contribution made by civil society. And I think it's very necessary. One thing that we are very clear of, that even if government or private sector or donors fund civil society, it does not take that autonomy away. It's very important because we are organized community. It's constituency that we represent. 18 sectors, traditional leaders, traditional health practitioner, because one of the member of committee, honorable member, it made input about 60 to 70% of people go to traditional health. They are a constituency. All traditional lead, health practitioners have organizations that come together to account as traditional health practitioners. So we speak in that voice where we are collected and collective in that manner. Now on the issue of funding, Chair, we've started those two initiatives that the CEO was referring to because one thing that members of this committee must realize, we have a crisis of funding. There's money that we're seeing, but it's not a reflection where communities are recipients of this money. We must be very clear because the many affected communities of 18 sectors are not necessarily the recipients of this money. So I'm just making that call that while we look at accountability, we must also interrogate the funding dissemination of these resources. And very lastly, to make the point, Chair, that I have not discussed this with the team from the Trust Secretariat or any of my leaders, it's the politics of funding. If you take the arguments of how the U.S. government that now has not even signed a country document, which is Global Fund that the CEO was talking about, it's politicized in a number of manner. And of course the president and the deputy president must articulate and review that, because what does it mean for bilateral agreements of this country? We are not implementing any U.S. government priority, we are implementing South African government or South African priorities. And it's very important that any other state that is seeking to support our own government must follow the voices of its own people. So I'm just putting it that we analyze, we interrogate, because that's where we are. As civil society, we will continue to do that. TEC, which is here, Chair, so that we clear that, and I want us not to leave this house with the assumption of our role as civil society. It's a member of civil society. Our role is to advocate and monitor our own government, ourselves, private sector. Many of the structures and priorities that are put out there, like community clinic committees, hospital boards, it called on communities to be part of it. You also called on organized communities to be part of it. So which means whatever that we see that is of discomfort, that lacks accountability, that is corrupt, will be voiced out. And civil society amongst the stakeholders speak together. They speak. TAC or Sports, Arts and Culture or Access Chapter 2 will speak to COSATU and others to say, observe, human resource issues are there and many others. So I want us to then leave with that notion that civil society is contributing. They are not fighting government, they are not fighting parliament, they are not fighting judiciary. It's contributing as organizers it is.
No, no, thank you very much. I think that was very important, and in my closing I'll start with it, which is, fortunately Jackie is here, in my other formal activism work is that at times, and I want you as leaders of this society, at times is that the issue is not what you are raising, it's how you raise it. I was raising this because I couldn't then, because I have to try and find the balance and not being seen as being defensive of that particular district in that particular province on how management was handled. And it now it gives me, it comes back to me that I must then be bold enough to put them, because there is that, which is, it, you know that the world, this is a sifamum domi. So if there is that particular, it then gives a particular. That's why I was saying, I'm not saying they are wrong, but it is the way that issues are being raised and the to strike. Where does, if I can say, where does it start and where does it end, and what then becomes the role? Because we can't do away with the civil society, because they are the ears, the mouth, and the eyes of the ordinary people on the ground. Politics of funding, there's no free lunch, the number of things that are, apart from that, the number of things that are being raised. We are in a very difficult political environment now, but how then do we ensure that we protect them? Because they are to be protected. They are to be protected. I always say there's nobody who was born corrupt. It is the environment and the circumstances. And how then do we ensure that? So I'm happy that you have raised that. The second thing is that I want to thank you, as much as it's late in the day that we have called SANAC, but as we are moving forward, because we're towards the end of the term, and nobody knows whether we are all coming back, but we are going to leave a report that then begins to say whichever is then going to be part of this will know what is the work that we have done. But critical, as I was listening to the responses, I said, hey, we have lost an opportunity in these 4 years, because your responses will have assisted us a bit. There's that process of asking questions to the ministers, we just ask questions to the president. We do ask questions, but I picked up that our questions would have been limited, because we have never been exposed and empowered in really understanding what is this animal called SANAC. It deals with the HIV and AIDS and whatever. But some of the things that now we have brought light to ourselves. There is and I'm very happy because we've also raised that in this report of yours, the very vulnerable area in the health sector, mental health. I always say, I don't know, because I mean, first I always used to say, I don't even care if it can get a salary of a million rand. I used to say in my workplace, a million rand a month, I'll never go into psychiatry. I was very young that time. But as we grow up, we really understand that nobody in this house can be positive. That doc, you know, that I am free of any mental disease, because there's that thin line between sanity and insanity. But a number of things that people are subjected to that make them to. So it you must also ensure that we lift up these issues, because those are very, the only area that we didn't talk about, maybe not, ourselves, we didn't ask questions. The people with disabilities. was they're exposed to a number, they're vulnerable to a number of things. So when in the next time when you come with your presentation, maybe because it was for the first time, we're excited that you're going to come. In our invitation, we didn't want deliberately, I didn't want to say to her, they must reflect on this. I just left it open so that ourselves also are then going up to learn. And when in the next invitation, in whatever time, also reflect to us that it is a stakeholder representing labor. What is happening in this place? What is really happening in that space? I think, and I've you have said something that I nearly fell off my chair, being a virgin, but being involved in anal sex. Oh my God, what is this? So in that SADC PF, there are a number of things also that we were then taken aback on, the things that are happening, which we must talk about them. Because if we don't talk about them, our children, our great-grandchildren will still be swimming in this sea of confusion, which is then destroying themselves. So I want to say, really, it has been an empowering process. We will come back to the Secretariat on some of the reports that would really in preparing for, because we're still going to have some sittings. Parliament will be rising sometime maybe towards the end of the year, if we are to ask questions so that people understand. I don't know whether you were there yesterday. The unfortunate part is that we don't discuss what happened, utterances in the House. But you had heard yourself. So that's why I always, and I'm saying without any fear or favor and being apologetic, all these things that we're talking about don't have color. They don't have political affiliation. No matter which class you are, you will be. So we have then got that responsibility of ensuring that this is not about a particular agenda but it's about the issue of the entire nation, because we want to ensure that as we will be living this, we leave our children become better leaders than ourselves in the My last a request will be to you, CEO, is that if it's possible, if you do have, you will reflect, if you don't have, maybe in writing, this, what is happening in that space of basic education? Was that in that the teenage pregnancy and HIV and AIDS and all STIs and all TB in that area, so that we are able, if we really sit, because this thing of departments working in silos makes everybody to be confused, and you think that things are not being done. When things are being done, people are holding them in their corners. And I want to thank the civil society for coming. I was teasing others. I said, oh my God, you people are here, you are so early in the morning. I caught TV. I hope we are not going to sit in this meeting and see a placard. And they laughed. I was teasing them. But why did you wake up so early in the morning? But I think it's quite an interesting and an empowering process. And I hope they are not only coming here because it's SANAC. Because committees are an open, they should go, and in civil society, when we've got a committee sitting, come and because issues that we are that are being raised there are issues that are in the mandate of the department, even in basic education, even in higher education. So I hope that it's not only because it's SANAC that is here. We will see them in our next sitting. We'll see them when we come back. We'll go and attend when there's a committee of women. The committee of women and children, go and this, because that is your space. Precisely because you are to start from bottom. As yesterday we said, the ABCs of hygiene. Our people are not interested in this high-powered English that we are. They are interested in what is it that this government, led by the African National Congress, is going to change their lives. And in changing their lives, it's not about only the Department of Health, it's about all of us coming together. We have different views, we have got different, but what is important is, in the center, we have got that responsibility. How then do we bring all those minds? It's not about competition, it's about complementing one another. So I think I will talk with you before report one of them, because they always, I'll tell you when, because I don't want to say it now. I will talk with you. Otherwise, thank you very much. Unfortunately, I don't know whether it's yourself. There's no lunch in this committee too. I don't know. But I will request, as they are preparing to leave, thank you very much, CEO, Presidency, thank you very much. I did reflect to you that I did, to a principal, to say SANAC is coming, knowing that he is not going to come, but for him to just be aware. But thank you very much. I will request the members of the committee to remain while they are preparing to leave.
So we are then going to come back immediately when
we are sorting one area above Mashalera. Yeah, immediately there is clarity on what is happening, will indicate. We'll then say, in the next, are we sorting in the next?
No.
Today, we have to indicate today. Or we'll have to indicate today. Because we're living next to it, so we'll indicate by the end of today. In fact, people that in the ANC are living, obviously the chair is the delegation, Honorable Mashalela, Honorable Ndaba, and Honorable Maisel. Those are the four. But immediately, she clarified Babu Mashalela, we'll then come back, there may be changes, and then he will then look into that. What is important is that you will have to know today, whatever, if there are going to be necessary changes, is the issue of a passport. It has been very difficult. We're making the application every year. After the bill, we then have to say, no, this time it can't be. So we will indicate, honourable members. We hope. Yeah, I think we'll be in the house. Of your guys is going to be on that thing, and immediately there is then an indication. I will just indicate for Congress to for us to just have a little bit of a chat and take it from there. Otherwise, that is that. Are we not having a session next week? We are meeting on Wednesday. Remember that next week is the last week we are again breaking for 2 weeks. So next week is the last week. We will then appreciate if members can then back on. But yeah, I think that is that. So when I get the message and I'm looking into the house and Babu Nabantu, nothing, I take a decision, what is then going to be the situation. But please, I'm sure by the time Sikala, or even during, before the house adjourn, we have met and then say what is then the situation. But that is it. It will be at that time that we'll also say, Siakopi. For now, as is was good, said Siakopi, but we have been granted a trip.
Wasn't good.